This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
...who, as his first report to the listener was broadcast, mentioned that he had listened to WBAI when he was on the air in Philadelphia. And that he was an especial fan of that late night guy, Bob Fass. And I thought, oh, I'm gonna be employed. I'm gonna be employed. And as an out of work actor, as I was at that moment, steady employment in a not too demeaning job is a wonder of nature, unalienated work, which is something that Chris and I both have had the pleasure of doing many times, is a rare and wonderful gift. Chris Albertson is a producer of records, most famously the complete works of Bessie Smith. He is credited with having brought the great Alberta Hunter back into the limelight at a certain time. And he was a station manager at WBAI. He has opinions about WBAI, and I'm going to turn the microphone on. I'm going to ask him not to be too rude to anybody, especially the people in this room. And
I'll behave.
Well, it's not so easy sometimes to overlook certain things.
True.
Wouldn't you say? And in the history of WBAI, there have been some terrible conflicts between idealists that have resulted in the shunning and the excommunicating, in a way, out of communication, in the non-religious sense, of certain members of the WBAI community. So you might want to say something about that and what it was that brought us together this time. And I'll shut up.
You want me to start?
Sure.
Why don't you just ask me some questions if you have any? I hadn't listened in many, many years to WBAI. I confess that I kind of fell out of the habit. But then, I think it was last November or somewhere around there, I just happened across it on the dial. And I couldn't believe it was WBAI. Because all I heard was people talking about
faith healing and all kinds of medicine
and medicine alternatives. And
you better say that again. I inadvertently cut your microphone.
Huh? You what?
What was it that you heard?
They were talking about faith healing, and it sounded like snake oil thing. It sounded like an infomercial, because they were also pushing DVDs and I thought I had the wrong station.
Well, you might have tuned into the middle of our marathon.
Well, that it turned out that I did, yes.
Yeah, now, if you remember...
I heard something similar tonight before I left the house.
I'm not clear in my mind whose idea having a marathon was, yours or mine, in those days.
I'll tell you exactly how that happened.
But...
if you want to hear it.
Well, but you're familiar with a certain thing that happens during marathons. Where sometimes we would play Kate Smith.
Yes.
Because people would say, get her off the air. I'll contribute anything so that you get back to regular programming.
That's right. The point was to annoy them into paying us some money, which they did. But it all started when my predecessor went to Europe on an extended vacation during the summer months, which, as you know, is the worst time for donation, subscription money. And so we were, it sounds silly now, you know, when you're talking in millions, but we were $25,000 in debt, and that was just devastating, you know. How are we ever going to do that? And so I was having lunch with Joanne Grant, who was our news director. And we were talking about this, and I said, I don't know what we should do, but we finally sort of discussed it, and we came to the conclusion, well, why do they pay us money? Why do they send us money? Because they like what they hear on the air. So why don't we take it away from them and tell them they won't get it back until they pay up some money? So we did that at 6 o'clock that evening. I broke into her news and said, that's it, you know, we need $25,000. And it was amazing because it was we were totally unprepared for it. I don't know if this is true, but there was a lady who came from Pacifica a few years back to see me. And she was writing a book about on-air fundraising. And she said, everything I do, every research I do, comes back to you. And this was the first fundraising marathon on the air anywhere. It may well be, I don't know. But we certainly didn't have any model.
Jerry Lewis.
That came later.
No,
didn't it?
I think not.
This was 64, I think. I think it came a little later.
I think Jerry Lewis was.
But it's certainly probably the first.
There was his
he's,
kids
of course,
in the,
he's raising money
in
for,
the 50s.
For a disease.
But that was on television.
And we were raising money for ourselves, you know, to stay alive. And but what happened during the first 2 hours somewhere, somebody called up and said, I don't have any money, but I have this very nice carpet. It's a Turkish carpet, and I would like to give that to someone who donates $200 to the station. Well, we weren't prepared for that at all, so that's how that whole barter thing started. So we announced that and very quickly got the $200. But what we also got, all these calls, people had turtles and baseballs and you remember what it looked
yes,
like.
Yes, I do. We had some of those turtles. There was a bathtub
yes.
in the station in those days.
Yes, if you could get past the teletype machine, there was the bathtub because it was a very small bathroom.
Right, I remember people used to say, dirty hippie, and I would say, no, look, a bathtub.
And we had turtles in the bathtub.
That's right.
I think we had a couple of canaries.
There was
a cage.
Boa constrictor.
I mean, it was amazing. It looked like a secondhand shop. After a while, and one there was a it got a lot of press. You got editorial in the New York Times, and it was even in the London press. And there was a lady in England, concert pianist, and she said, I read about you people and I think it's wonderful what you're doing. Here is a tape. She sent us a tape of herself playing some concerto, and she said, just use it any way you want. If it can make some money for you, then I'll be happy. So it was that kind of thing. And I remember some kids came down from Yonkers or something with the content of their piggy bank, and then we had it was a very honest marathon. You know, we said we would stop the minute we had 25,000 in pledges, and we did. And
what was the rate of return, do you remember?
That was the amazing thing. We got 75% We got more than pledge. That's what it was. We got over the pledge, and I was told that if you get 75%, you've had a successful marathon. You know, then you had a successful fundraising. But we got more actually, and we had, you know, remember our printer? I can't remember his name. Very nice man.
We
printed our folio.
And always on
and
credit.
He was, you know, a small businessman.
He would be months behind.
Yes, we owed him money.
Yeah.
So he came on the air and we talked about the money we owed him. And then people started calling in just to help pay that bill. You know, they specified this is for the printer bill. And then at one point, Yoko Ono came to my office, and you know, she was working as a volunteer file clerk for John Corigliano in the music department. And she was so quiet always. You know, she was like the last person I could imagine on the air doing anything. You know, and she came to my office and said she'd very much like to do something on the air for the marathon. And I said, "What would you like to do?" She said, "Well, I'd like to sing some Japanese children's songs." So I said, "Great." So she did, and it was very funny because she described each song before she sang it. It was very beautiful, very poetic descriptions. You know, this little butterfly, and it's fluttering around, and it lands on a beautiful red rose, and she gives this picture. You know, and then she stops her story and goes. She makes all these sounds. The song, the contrast between the song and her description of the song was so incredible. But anyway, she was there, and I don't know if she raised any money, but she was there.
I remember she did a series of Japanese court music,
Gagaku, yes.
It was quite an education.
This is before she met John Lennon. This is where she was married to an American named Cox. I think he was a poet. Mm-hmm. Do you remember him?
I'm sure I met them. They lived around the corner from me on Prince
Street. But anyway,
Street.
The marathon was so successful that the Pacifica called me. And they said, "What did you do? We want you to come out and do the same thing here." So I sat down and I wrote a manual. I don't know whatever happened to it. I'd love to see it today. Based on our experiences, you know, I wrote a little manual. This is, avoid this, do this. You know, this works, this doesn't work. And then I flew out to KPFK first, I think. I did a marathon there. And then I went to KPFA, did a marathon there. And they were all successful. But they were all honest, see. Then the next year, they continued it. But now they were no longer honest. I remember I went out for the one at KPFK, and the manager, Paul Dallas, I don't know if you ever knew him, but he would just tell people to, you know, to lie, say that we got this barter thing and we don't have it, you know, and just make up stories, just do anything. And that that really appalled me. Because we had really been scrupulously honest. And when we did our second marathon the following year, an old lady, we were on Murray Hill, remember? Our station was located on Murray Hill. 30 East 39th, yes. And an old lady came by to see me, and she had a manila envelope, and she said, I have never heard of your station, but I happened upon it. And you young people sound so nice and so desperate. I know you really need the money. And I was going to give this to Vassar, but I thought it would be better to give it to you. And it was personal letters from Elizabeth Barrett Browning. There were like three or four of them, long, handwritten letters. Beautiful. And I forget how much we got for it, but we got a lot of money for it. So you never know what happens. And we had no premiums.
Those were the first premiums.
Hmm?
Those were the first premiums.
Well I guess the barter, but it was a little different because the listeners supplied the premiums, didn't they?
Now, when you talk of those days, you're animated and you're having fun. It must have been fun for you to have that job then.
What, as a manager?
Didn't it feel like a kind of something that you were good at, that you were doing well, that you were having fun doing?
Well, it was a very mixed feeling, I have to tell you. You know, it was fun in one way, and you know how I became manager, because they had always gotten managers from the outside. They had never taken someone from the staff. That was something new. But as the manager I mentioned
what
before.
What had you been doing on the station before?
I started as a volunteer. I was doing, you know, all kinds of things, did some in the mail room or wherever they needed me. And I was working at WNEW.
Right, at that time.
And, but then they asked me if I would be an announcer because they knew I had been a disc jockey in Philadelphia. So then I got a. No, what happened was this was funny. Before I went to WNEW, I had gone to unemployment. But it had been like months and months and months, and I thought I was dead. And I got home one day from NEW, and there was a letter from the unemployment office. They wanted to discuss a job that I might be interested in. So I said, what kind of job is it? He said, well, it's a small radio station, but I have to warn you, it's a communist station. You might not like it. So I said, WBAI? He said, yes, oh, you've heard of it. I said, I'm already working there.
And they made the sign of the cross to you, right?
But then I knew that there was an opening for an announcer, so I applied for that and got it. That's how I got that. And then our station manager went to Europe, as I said, and came back. And he had this habit of coming back and finding the station in deep debt and walking around, laying people off, and then he'd pass you in the hallway and say, well, you know, you'd be happy to hear that you're not going to be laid off this week. So morale was really terrible.
Prince of a fella.
So we had heard that Halleck Hoffman, who was the president of the Pacifica Foundation, was coming in from the West Coast. And we never saw a board member, you know. They didn't listen to the station. They never came to the station unless there was some kind of a crisis, and there hadn't been one yet. So we decided we would all each write an individual letter of resignation and give it to Halleck Hoffman when he came in. So everybody at the station except Baird Searles, who was the head of our drama and literature department, he was the only one who didn't resign, but we all resigned. And we handed him this envelope with all these letters in it. He disappeared into the manager's office for about an hour, came out and said, I have accepted all your resignations. And no, he said, I've accepted Mr. Binn's resignation, appointed myself interim manager, and as interim manager, I have accepted all your resignations. And that leaves me as the manager of a station without a staff. So if you want to sign up for appointment, I'll be conducting job appointments this afternoon. And at these job interviews, he asked each one of us what we thought was wrong with the station, or what we would do if we were in charge. And he made me a production manager. And then about 2-3 weeks after he went back to the coast.
In those days, WBAI produced its...
Yes.
Share of its own programs.
Yeah, we did a lot of production. Those tape recorders were running all night. there was a lot of heavy production.
And these programs were distributed to other stations.
Yes.
And they were recorded on Thursday and played on Saturday.
And sometimes bought by commercial stations.
Right.
So then about 2-3 weeks later, he called and from the coast and said, asked me if I would like to be the general manager. So I said, I've never done any fundraising. I don't know anything about fundraising. So I have two conditions. One is that the board help me with fundraising, and the other is that I have to have the approval of all the staff. So I got that. So the staff approved. I was waiting for the board to help me with fundraising. And I went on, I did that first report to the listener that you heard. And what I remember saying was that I don't want to ask you for money now, but I want to ask you to listen and see if you don't hear a change, and if that change doesn't make you want to support us. And then, of course, the money started coming in right away. But and Joe Bintz was gone forever. And things went very smoothly, I think, except that I didn't get any help from the Pacifica Foundation or Halleck or anybody. But he called me one day and said, "Chris, you'll be very happy to know that I have finally talked my father into giving money to WBAI. I said, "Wonderful." Because I had been to Halleck Hoffman's father's, Paul Hoffman was his name. He was the first president of the Rockefeller Foundation. He was a former president of Studebaker, you know, and he was somebody on Roosevelt, member of Roosevelt's cabinet, and lived on Sutton Place, and was, you know, obviously had a lot of money. So I told the staff, you might have been at the staff meeting, that we were expecting a check. It was all wonderful, great news. Then the check came in. It was a check for $12.50, and it came in just before our rates went up to 15. And about a few days later, I got a call from a lady who said she was the private secretary to Dr. Stanton of CBS. And she said, "I'm only calling to confirm the address because Dr. Stanton wants to make a sizable contribution to the station." So I said, "Oh, wonderful." So I gave her the address. And the check, and this time I didn't say anything, but the check came, and it was a check for $100. That was a substantial contribution from the president of CBS.
Well, probably in her estimation, the underpaid peon working for the head of a network. You know, it seemed like a lot of money to her.
Yeah, but we managed.
Seems like a lot of money to me, actually.
We got more money from R. Peter Strauss, who recently married Monica Lewinsky's mother. Uh-huh. That was because I used to take a cab to work, and one day...
She's your daughter, not mine.
One day, the cab driver had the radio on. It was WMCA, what is it, the Good Guys? And they had a contest, and you had to get the WMCA call letters on some part of your body, any part, but with the help of a suntan, and then take a picture of it.
I remember that.
And the clearest suntan won the car. So Bob Potts and I were doing a morning show on BAI. And I started talking about this. And we said, well, this is, you know, very unfair to people who have darker skin. And so we started doing a thing. We did a whole little skit where we had people up on the roof of WBAI, and they were all baking, and we were checking to see how they were coming along, like baked potatoes. And I gave the phone number of the station and told them to call WMCA and complain about this. And about 10 o'clock, and that morning, I get a call from the PR person at WMCA. "What are you doing to us?" I said, "Nothing." "Well, you know, we never thought of that. You know, we're sorry about that. We never thought of that, but you should have thought of it," I said. So then I got a call a little bit later that Mr. Strauss wanted to donate to the station, give the station $1,000. And they wanted me to come over so they could have a picture taken of him giving me the $1,000. I still have that picture. But then he also took out three ads in the New York Times. And the ads basically, it was a little, like a little coupon, and it said, if you want to hear this and this, then WMCA. But if you want to hear, you know, things you never hear anywhere else, then you subscribed to WBAI.
What were those things in those days?
I don't know what they were, but they never brought in any money. We didn't get a single response.
No, but what were the things that you could hear on WBAI that you couldn't hear on other places in those days?
A lot of things. Well, we played music, and of course we often played music that you couldn't hear elsewhere. But we also, whenever something was happening, if Malcolm X was giving a speech or something, we were up there with a tape recorder. You know, we were covering it. And not for the news, but we would do these special programs. And things like when Chris Koch went down south and did that wonderful series, This Little Light, which was a long series.
With Dale Minor.
With Dale Minor, yeah.
Won an award.
Yes. And so what happened was we got a $10,000 grant from something called the Taconic Foundation. I don't know who they are. And the stipulation was that it had to be used for civil rights broadcasting. And we were not allowed to mention their name in connection with it. And so we didn't mention
their
name.
Has the statute of limitations run out on that? you just did that.
Well, what I did was I was always into gadgets. And they had just come out with some wireless microphones. So I bought a couple of wireless microphones. And we remember we had a Nagra and we had another fairly good machine. And the people in the South, when Dale or Chris or somebody from our station, anybody from the North actually, wanted to interview them, they were very reluctant. They didn't want to talk to Northerners. So this way they could be interviewed and not know it. And that's how we got some really interesting interviews. And which reminds me of Marcia Tompkins. Do you remember Marcia Tompkins?
Sure. Sure. She was the turncoat daughter of a racist Ku Klux Klanner.
Yeah, right? No, well, her...
And she was dedicated to erasing that blot on her family escutcheon.
She was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Right.
Her father was the chief of police. And she had an uncle who was a sheriff in the next town or something. And she went home on vacation. I think it was Christmas time. And I let her have the little, one of our little tape recorders. The little tape recorders weren't really that little in those days. But she went to a Klan meeting, and she had the tape recorder under her coat, and she recorded the entire Klan meeting. You know, you could hear the cross crackling, the burning and crackling. And then somebody saw this bulging, and somebody got a little suspicious. So they told her to wait, and the Grand Wizard's wife came over, and they were waiting for the Grand Wizard, and she said, and all this time the tape is running, so you hear this. And she said, "Ain't you Marcia Tompkins?" And she said, "Yes." "We went to school together." So that gave her a little time, you know. So finally she managed to run to her car. And you hear her breathing and running because the tape recorder ran. And she didn't go home. That's what she did. I did a series called You Can't Go Home Again. Because she drove right to New York. But before that, she had recorded secretly the family in the family living room. And she did it secretly because she wanted everybody to hear what a Southern family, how they talked about, you know, racial things when they didn't think anyone was listening. And on one of the tapes, her father said, "Well, you wouldn't marry a nigger." And she said, "What do you mean, Dad?" "Well, I mean, you wouldn't marry Sammy Davis Jr." They always brought up Sammy Davis Jr. And she said, "No, I don't think so." And he said, "Well, I didn't think you would." She said, "Because you would never accept him. I couldn't bring him home." It was a wonderful series.
She didn't say,
"Well, he's Jewish."
"He's Jewish."
Yeah. That's right. No, she didn't say that. but the Klan tape was bought by the Danish radio and by the BBC, and a little old lady in Detroit. And this little old lady came to see me one day. Her husband made a lot of money. He made metal cabinets. And for her birthday, he had given her an FM station. And she didn't know what to do with it. So she'd heard about WBAI, and she came to see me. And so, you know, she wanted programs. So when she saw the KKK program, she immediately wanted that, which surprised me. She bought several programs. I eventually flew up there and helped her start the station, because I suggested that she make it a classical music station, because the classical music station in town had just closed down and gone to rock. So there was no classical music, you know. So I said, this is what you do. So that's what she did. But then her husband gave her stereo. He converted the station to stereo, so she got that. And it was funny, when I was up there, I was there twice. The first time I was up there, she had a Thunderbird in every color that was made. And she took me to lunch. And we came out from lunch, this big parking lot, you know, and she looked very confused. She said, "Chris, do you remember what color the car was?" That was one of the wonderful things about BAI. You met some really incredible people, you know. I wish I could remember all their names.
These were people who they weren't whimsical. They weren't crazy. They were eccentric.
Yes.
And you're eccentric when you're whimsical or crazy, but you have a lot of money.
Yes, yes. She was rich and eccentric. But if some of the people who just came in to volunteer, you know, were also rather eccentric.
You introduced me to Lord Rosti.
Oh, Lord Rosti, yes. That was a strange thing. He came in one day, and he was a very, very tall Italian man, very imposing, and he had this fur coat with a Persian lamb collar, and he sort of took the coat off with a flourish, you know, and he had a hat and a cane and nice beard and this beautiful accent. He started telling me about His Serene Highness, Prince, what was his name?
Robert Rohan de Courtenay.
The pretender to the
Byzantine
Empire.
Yes.
Yes. And he had to be crowned. He had to have a coronation. But Byzantine law was very demanding. You had to have certain things. You had to have, for instance, 12 flamingos of a certain breed. And you had to have 10 virgins. And he said, and Lord Rusty said, and in this day and age, where would you find a virgin? You know, I mean, it was like, that's how impossible it was.
Let alone 10.
And I did an interview, which I think you have in the archives, because I think I saw that online. But I haven't heard it in many years. And so finally he brought His Serene Highness by. And he was a very little man, and he really looked the part. I mean, he had this waxed mustache, and he had this incredible clothing and a big sash and medals and all that. And he was very, very European and bowing and so forth. And they were so serious that I just, you know, responded accordingly, you know. And they wanted to take me out for a drink. So we were right off Madison Avenue, and this was around 5 o'clock. So we went to one of these places where all these ad people go after work, you know. And it was kind of crowded when we got there, and we walk in, and, I mean, all conversation stopped. I mean, it just stopped. It was like someone had turned it off. And they were all looking. As Lord Rusty is going through his little act and the prince, and I get very embarrassed with that sort of thing. I was probably red as a beet, couldn't wait to get out of there. But anyway, that was it. So we decided to have a coronation. And you remember the cheetah?
Yes, I do, yeah.
That was like one of the first discos, wasn't it?
That's right.
And so we managed to get the cheetah, have the coronation of the cheetah, and Andy Warhol agreed to be the person who actually placed the crown on the his Serene Highness's head. And we had some performers there, including Tiny Tim. And Richard Lemparsky was involved, and he had gotten a hold of we'd rented or gotten on loan some antique cars, beautiful cars, maybe four or five of them. And they started at Columbus Circle and drove down, bringing the prince to the cheetah. And there were little girls with baskets and rose petals, and they threw rose petals in his path as he walked in, you know. And it was quite the thing. And I went backstage, and there was a show in town called Gorilla Queen, and the star of that show was there in his gorilla costume. So you had this gorilla. And then you had Tiny Tim with his little shopping bag, and then you had this stripper. So they was the three of them sitting together, very strange.
Joselle was there, wasn't she?
Who?
Joselle, the snake dancer.
That's yes. Yeah. You remember well, yes. Uh-huh. And but then when it came time to actually perform the coronation, nobody could find the crown. We had rented this. It looked very good. And everybody's running frantically around trying to find that crown, and Andy Warhol didn't know what to do. And the gorilla queen is swinging on a vine or a rope, something through the... It was a true happening, you know. It was so bizarre. It was so very WBAI. And I had never seen any pictures from it. I wish it had been photographed. But that was the sort of thing. Richard Lemparsky was very good at this sort of thing, you know. Because I don't know if I told you how I met Richard Lemparsky.
How was that?
He came to the station one day and said he had this idea of interviewing has-beens. And he thought it would be very good because the world is full of has-beens and there's a has-been born every minute. So, and he said, and this would be politicians and movie stars, everything, you know. And so I said, that sounds interesting. Well, why don't we do that? So we decided to do a half hour a week. And it was called Whatever Became Of. Whatever Happened To was the original title. And then he was supposed to come back and record it. And he never came back. And I didn't know what happened. So about a year later, he came back. I said, what happened to you? He said, oh, I went on an island vacation. I said, really? But you were supposed to be... Well, it was Rikers Island. he had been selling pornographic pictures of young boys to people in the theater, on Broadway, George Abbott and people like that, and doing a brisk business with it. And those pictures, I mean, if today you might find them on your milk carton, you know, they're very innocuous. But anyway, that landed him in jail. And because he had worked for one of the studios as a PR man, they put him in charge of movies at Rikers Island. And what he did, he ordered all these esoteric Italian French movies. I mean, really way out there. Very, very esoteric movies.
Jean Andalou.
Yes. For all these guys at Rikers Island.
A nous la liberté. Right. Wow.
Great. So that was typical.
Great films, actually.
Typical of Richard.
Well, there were a lot of... A lot of reasons for the media to pay attention to WBAI beside what was on the air. But do you remember what the programs were that were on in those days? What was the music? And who were the personalities that?
Well, because of my background, when I came in, we started having a lot of jazz, because I knew, you know, the jazz musicians. So I got Marion McPartland, who didn't think she could do a radio show. And she said she did a radio show once a week. And then, well, you remember Ira Gittler and Dan Morgenstern, all the top critics were doing shows. And then on Saturdays, we had a two-hour slot, Saturday afternoons, 2 to 4. And I thought it would be a good idea to rotate and just have musicians come in and do whatever they wanted to do. They could play live, they could play records, they could just sit and talk, whatever. So that worked out very well, because we had, you know, Coltrane came in, and all these, you know, top musicians, you know, the modern ones as well as the Eddie Condon crowd, Jimmy Rushing, people like that.
Were those performances recorded?
They were recorded, yes, and I often wonder if someone kept those. I wish they had. I think I have a couple in my closet. And as I told you when we spoke on the phone, I have you know, quite a few, not an awful lot, but I have some tapes from that period, because I used to work on tapes at home. I had the equipment and so forth, and it used to do some editing. And
what's that line from Eminem?
Hmm?
Tonight, I'm cleaning out my closet.
Well, I mean, I have a closet full of stuff.
Well,
and nothing to play them on.
You mentioned something really wonderful to me. I just, you know, I a lot of people that think about language and the culture think very highly of Lenny Bruce. And
yes.
You said that you had a tape of Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, this was when I was doing my Saturday night show, which was called The Inside. And Lenny came up several times in those days. And remember how Hoffman played him in the movie? I thought that was uncanny, that was so close to the real thing. Because Lenny, he was getting very paranoid for good reason. He had all these books, law books, under one arm. He never made a phone call that he didn't record. And he came up and he just started talking. And he said, you know, he took over the show. And said, you know, poor Chris, you know, things are not going well here at WBAI. Things are, you know, they don't have any money. He's down to one record. It's Goodbye, Mama. I'm off to Yokohama. And I mean, he could help.
Sure, it wasn't. Does the chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
And he urged them to send in, you know, jams and jellies, whatever they could, you know.
I did mean to interrupt you, but Bill remembered that you said that that song was crucial to your understanding of something.
What, the chewing gum?
Well, you had been at a recording session when that was caught. Was it? Were you not?
No.
Lonnie Donegan?
No, I recorded Lonnie Donegan. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, but I didn't record him doing that.
Ah, no.
No. No, I recorded Lonnie Donegan in 1953, before he became known.
In the United States?
No, I recorded him in Denmark. I like I told you, I was always into gadgets. So when B&O, the Danish company B&O, made their first they came out with a wire recorder, so I bought the wire recorder. And then when they came out with the first tape, I switched to tape. And Ken Collier's band came over from England to play in Denmark. And I recorded them, and there was Chris Barber and Ken Collier and Lonnie Donegan and so forth. And in fact, I brought a recording of that.
You did?
Did I? Oh, here.
Oh, well. Oh, and this wonderful book that you did about Bessie Smith.
That's yours, yes.
Oh, Chris, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I hope you inscribe
it. I did.
I'll wait till I'm alone to read it. that's really that's very nice of you. Thank you. Now, what is this?
This is the first recording that I ever made. This is 1953. This is one with Lonnie Donegan on banjo. And it's the Ken Collier Band. And I only had one microphone, but it was a ribbon mic. It wasn't too bad.
I see you went direct to CD in those days.
Yes, yes. But this came out in Denmark originally. Now this particular one, I saw it online from a British company, so I sent them an email and they sent me the record. Why don't you play Tiger Rag? Do you see Tiger Rag there? That was the very first one I did.
Yeah, okay. That's easy. you say that was done with just one microphone? Wow. I mean, so it's like so dimensional. No,
I know. It's amazing. That was a very good. It was a home tape recorder, but didn't have a meter on it. Had a little. Remember those green magic eyes?
Magic eyes.
Yeah. So that was the first thing I ever recorded. Then I brought some other records. If you want to look at, and these are commercial recordings I made over here. I went to New Orleans and did about 13 albums in 10 days in New Orleans in 1961. And I did the same thing in Chicago later that year. And then I recorded Ida Cox. Do you remember Ida Cox, the blues singer?
Didn't you also record the Preservation Hall Jazz Band?
No, they didn't exist. But because of my recordings, because I was down there, that's where Jaffe got the idea for Preservation Hall. So I was there in January, and Preservation Hall started a little bit later that year.
Well, I think I first saw them at Newport. So they...
You first heard what?
Preservation Hall.
Yeah. Well, many of the musicians who were ended up in Preservation Hall Band were musicians I recorded. They were wonderful, those people. I called the Musicians Union, and I told them that I was going to go down there, and I was sure that some of the people were not going to be in the union any longer because they were old and retired, and I thought it was very important to record them. And Mr. Zaccardi, who was the head of the American, it wasn't the local, it was the, you know, the main office. He said, by all means, whatever you want to do, record it. So that was very nice. And as it turned out, some of the people, because of the recordings, their careers were renewed, so they actually rejoined the union.
They're local, not 802. Hmm? They're local.
Down there. And there were two locals. They were segregated. There was a black local and a white local. And I only recorded black people, so I was dealing with a black local. But, you know, Philadelphia also had segregated locals at that time. But it was because the black local didn't want to join the white local because the officials there were doing very well, and they knew that they would lose their importance if they merged with the other locals. So, but that's all been straightened out. And there was some wonderful pictures on the covers of those the New Orleans recordings. They were taken by Ralston Crawford, who was quite a well-known photographer who had done a lot of photography in New Orleans. I just brought a handful of them because there were over 20 albums altogether from those trips.
I hardly know where to begin.
And one day I was walking down Broadway and I saw in a record store there was a record that said Songs My Mother Taught Me. And it occurred to me that I know these old ladies who probably taught his mother some songs. So I decided to do an album called Songs We Taught Your Mother. And that was Alberta Hunter's first recording in many, many years.
Lucille Hegeman
and Victoria Spivey. And I let them each do, I think, three selections. And
well, I'm overwhelmed. Bud Freeman.
Yeah, that's the first, you know, the pianist, Blizzard of Lies. Remember him? Look at the piano.
Dave Frischberg.
That was the first recording Dave Frischberg ever made, commercial recording. I didn't know that at the time, but he told me later.
Lonnie Johnson,
yes. I had a long history with Lonnie Johnson.
Little right. mother, little brother Montgomery, Mama Yancey.
Oh, yes.
See, these are wonderful, Chris.
They were all wonderful. Mama Yancey, when I had to, in Chicago, I rented because Riverside's budget was next to nothing. So I couldn't afford a studio. So I rented by day the Birdhouse, which was a modern jazz club. And so we used it by day, so they kept the bar open. And I was sitting at a table with Mama Yancey, who was, I forget how old she was, and she was up in years. And the engineer came to me and said, could we have Mrs. Yancey go to the microphone? I could test my balance. And she lifted up her glass of beer and said, honey, let Mama test her own balance first. Let Mama get her own balance first.
So, I mean, I'm so overwhelmed. What should I play?
Oh, whatever. The reason I brought some of the blues stuff is because it's the kind of stuff that I know you play and like.
Well,
but you have eclectic taste, so.
I like the blues, but I learned to love them at WBAI.
The Ida Cox album has Roy Eldridge and Coleman Hawkins accompanying her. With Joe Jones on drums, and her obituary had appeared in Variety 10 years earlier. But I went down to Chattanooga and found her living with her daughter, who was a school teacher, and when I finally got her to come up here to do this album, I took her around, and we went backstage at the Apollo. Count Basie was there, and Basie was in his dressing room. And he was sitting, facing the mirror, and he could see the door in the mirror. So we walked in, and Basie turned around and said, Ida? She said, yes, honey. Didn't you die? She said, yes, honey.
I think this is appropriate. I'm going to play Fogyism.
Oh, yes, Fogyism.
Believe in some old sign. Why do people believe in some old sign? To hear a hoot owl holler, someone is surely dying. Some will break a mirror, cry bad luck for 7 years. Some will break a mirror, cry bad luck for 7 years. And if a black cat crosses them, they'll break right down in tears. muddy water. Trouble is knocking at your door. To dream of muddy water, trouble is knocking at your door. Your man is sure to leave you, never coming back no more. When your man comes home evil, tell you you're getting old. When your man comes home evil, tell you you're getting old.
This is WBAI in New York City, and we are also heard on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and in about half an hour we'll be joined by WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty. My name's Bob Fass, and I'm sitting here with Bill Propp and Chris Albertson, who was the producer of that last recording and the recording before that, and I don't know how many other wonderful, wonderful recordings in the time that passed since you and I worked together at WBAI. I want to hear more of this music, but I know that there's something that you want to discuss relative to your tenure at WBAI 50 years ago.
Well, I didn't really come here to argue. I have a blog, and I wrote some things about BAI on the blog when I heard it again after all these years, and I was, you know, very disappointed. But I have to say that I've also heard some very good things on the station. They're just other times when I think that the airtime is so precious. And I was thinking there's a time when Lou Hill, who started this whole thing, he twiddled around on the radio dial and didn't hear anything of substance. This is right after World War II. So he decided something had to be done, and that's how Pacifica and the Pacifica stations came about. And it occurred to me that were he around today and were he twiddling his dials and listening, he might think that he might have landed on a Pacifica station and thought it was one of the other stations, because some of these programs are indistinguishable from what you hear elsewhere on the dial, and that just was not the case in the old days. And I don't think we should go back to the old days and be the way we were, but I think the mindset should be the same. We should be doing something that people can listen to and learn from. We had wonderful programs for young people. Do you remember that, Bob?
With Miss Christabel.
Yes.
Christabel Veresinger.
And I remember, what was his name? It was a wonderful old English gentleman. He wrote the Wizard of Oz screenplay and Ivanhoe screenplays. And he was retired to his farm in Virginia. And he had left Hollywood. And I kind of admired him for that, because he had so much going for him in Hollywood. And he just got sick of it. So he left.
But he had written a children's book called The Land of Green Ginger. And he agreed to record it for us, and which he did. And we had that going as a series of programs for young children. But we also got permission from him to put it out on an LP. And I remember I designed the cover, and that was a premium, I guess. We sold that to subscribers. Do you remember that, Land of Green Ginger?
I remember The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Wasn't that the same?
I don't know. That doesn't sound familiar. This had to do with dragons.
Could be. Could be.
But you know, Celeste Holm would come in and read children's stories, and I don't remember James Mason would come in. He spent a lot of time on location, different parts of the world, and he had this fascination for ethnic music. So wherever he was, he would look up the music and the instruments, and not only buy the records, but actually get into it, study the sort of history of it and so forth. And he came by a couple of times and recorded programs where he just played from his collection and talked about these wonderful things he had heard in Bali or this place or that place, you know. That was the sort of thing, you know, like Bob Dylan coming in and doing station call letters for you and station breaks for you, right?
He signed off. Exactly. And I played a terrible joke on him.
Yeah.
You know, how if you hook the earphones up to the playback head on the tape recorder, you hear yourself speaking like a fraction, a couple of seconds
yes.
after you speak, and it becomes impossible to speak clearly because you're blocking yourself out. And I did that to him when he was trying to sign off. He had some trouble with it.
Do you know, I don't know, I don't think I told you that I came here in 1941 originally when I was 10 years old. I had just met my father, and my mother and father made a deal. I was in Iceland, that he would have me for 1 year in New York. And, of course, a 10-year-old kid, I couldn't wait to get to New York. I mean, in New York, you saw these pictures of skyscrapers and so forth. I thought everybody was filthy rich. And so I was supposed to have been here a year, but it ended up being almost 3 years. But on the way out of Iceland, coming here in 1941, a U-boat wolf pack attacked our convoy. And do you remember the Reuben James?
Yes, sure.
I was there. I saw the Reuben James. I didn't see it go down, but I saw it get hit.
Really?
Because I was in a lifeboat on the... What were their names? Yes. And I didn't understand until much later when I found out what the Reuben James was, why when we got to New York, there was this crowd of the kind of journalists you see in the old 1930s movies, you know, gum chewing with their hat and tickets stuck out of the hat, you know, passes and flashing cameras and so forth. And that was because we were the only ship that they could talk with, that could talk to people who were on that trip. And but now I know, because I went to the library and I got all the, there were a lot of newspapers in those days in New York. And I got a lot of clippings of us on that boat. But I remember that very well. But that was the Reuben James. And I remember when I was a disc jockey in Philadelphia, I sometimes played that song. I never knew that that was the ship that I had seen get hit. You know, it wasn't the only ship I saw got hit, but that was one of them. But it was worse going back. 1944, we were hit worse by a U-boat pack in the middle of the Atlantic in June of 44. And when the smoke cleared and dawn came, we were the only ones there. I couldn't see another ship, and I had counted 50 ships. I just saw a little wreckage and stuff. So they took us to the nearest place, which was a place called Loch Ewe in Scotland. And we waited there at anchor for 5 days until there was another convoy that we could hitch on to go to Iceland.
That would have been just after Normandy, right? Mm. June 1944.
We were on the 17th of June 1944. We were on the Atlantic because I remember that was the day Iceland declared independence from Denmark, and everybody was listening. This is an Icelandic ship. Everybody was listening to the radio.
Well, he can probably do it. You can probably do it, Chris.
What?
Pronounce that volcano.
Eyjafjallajökull.
Let me hear that.
Eyjafjallajökull.
Eyjafjallajökull.
Eyja means island. Fjalla is mountain. And Jökull is glacier. Eyjafjallajökull.
It just rolls right off your tongue.
Yeah, of course. I ain't Icelandic for nothing.
We'll save this snippet and play it back a few times and learn it that way.
I heard one person, one news person, pronounce it almost correctly, you know. But I've heard some really incredible pronunciations of that in the last few days.
Well, what was it you said that the people who live near the volcano need?
Oh, yes. Vowels.
Vowels. That's a good one.
Not as good as Eyjafjallajökull.
Eyjafjallajökull. Yeah.
I'll try it when I get home. Well, this has really been very pleasant, Chris. But I called you because of something that was somewhat less than pleasant. You admitted to a certain feeling of, I don't know, I guess, is betrayal too strong a word?
I think it is, yes. Betrayal is too strong a word, yeah.
Well, there was an incident.
There was an incident,
that
yes.
That you were thought to be central to, I think.
Yes. Do you want to hear about that incident? Well, when I was manager, Chris Koch was the program director. And one day Chris Koch said he was going to go to Paris, going on his vacation to Paris, you know. And off he went. And he came back. I said, how was Paris? Oh, he said, wonderful. And next year I want to go back and take my family. And that was that, you know. And then the next thing I know, I get a call from one of the networks. And they say, what time is the press conference? I said, what press conference? The Chris Koch press conference. Well, I didn't know anything about it. So I went to Chris's office, and I said, what's this about, a press conference? Oh, yes, I should have told you. I called the press conference because I just went through Paris. I really went to Hanoi. So I said, well, I really think you could have told me that. You know, make me look like a fool. I don't know what's going on here. And he said, well, I didn't want to tell you, but that's what happened. So then I told the board.
Now, at this time, the State Department made it impossible for American reporters to go to North Vietnam.
Oh, it was absolutely forbidden, yes. Yeah. And that's why the board was concerned, you know. But it just so happened that I had a board meeting just around that time. I went to California, and so I told the board what happened. And these board members were just so awful. You know, they were scared of it, with some exception. They were scared of everything, you know. And they right away started thinking, well, what consequences can it have? And
The State Department is going to call the FCC, and the FCC is going to have a hearing, and that's the best thing that can happen, and we'll have to pay for lawyers and lawyers and... Right.
So they wrote a letter to Chris Koch, which, you know, I didn't know anything about till he got it. And it was an incredible letter. I think I have it at home. About, you know, that what he had done and how grievous that was, and he put the station and the whole Pacifica Foundation in danger, and it was, you know, it was overreacting. But of course the letter was there not for Chris Koch so much as just in case something happened with this. They had this letter, right?
Deniability.
Yes, that was their game.
CYA.
So Chris had a, you know, tape recorder with him, and he made a lot of interviews.
My tape recorder with him.
Was it yours? Oh.
I was the only person at the station that knew he was going to Hanoi because he borrowed my Uher.
Oh. Well, he started doing producing a series of tapes about the trip. And I remember the first one was it was innocuous. It was something like as the wings of our planes, you know, flew over the mountain, left Paris. It was almost like a travelogue. But then in the second one, he started getting into it. And he asked me what I thought about it. And I said, you know, I think you're doing yourself a disservice, because every time he mentioned something Americans had done, like leaflets thrown by Americans, he would read off what the leaflet said. And then he would say, whatever that's supposed to mean. So I said, that wasn't necessary to say whatever that's supposed to mean. The leaflet speaks for itself, you know. We have intelligent listeners, and you just put yourself in a place when you say that. And he said, yeah, you're right, you're right. He then went in and removed those references. I didn't ask him to, he didn't have to, but he went and did it himself. Then I was, when the second program was supposed to air for the first time, I had gone out to dinner. I came home, I don't know, it was 8 o'clock or something. It was almost home, WBAI. And he was walking out, and he said, you'll get my resignation in the morning. I said, what happened? You'll get it in the morning. He just kept going. So I went upstairs and asked, I forget who the announcer was, it may have been Steve Post or whoever. And I said, what happened? And he said, oh, Chris is very mad because you pulled the tape. I said, I didn't pull any tape. He said, well, it's not in the bin. So we went looking for it, and it was on Maria's desk. Remember Maria, our traffic manager?
She had
left, and we had this other one who was impossible, whom I had hired, but who was really awful. But she had not put it in the bin.
In those days, the programs went from the producer to the traffic manager, and she would put them in the appropriate bin in the control room.
There was a bin for every
Tuesday,
day.
Tuesday, Wednesday, right.
Yeah.
And
so the person who was on duty would just, you know, pull the next tape and put it on, unless it was a miscellany. And so we put it back. But it was too late. So I rescheduled this for the next night. I said, we've moved something or something, you know. So I called Harold Taylor, who was the head of the New York board, and told him what had happened. And he said, well, Chris called me, and he said he's resigning. So I said, well, how can we avoid that? Because this is all a mistake. You know, he's reacting to something that didn't happen. So he said, well, why don't we all meet at my place? So he had a brownstone in the village, and we went down there, I think, next night or something. And both Harold and I tried to talk Chris into staying. And he said, no, he had his mind made up. He was going to leave anyway. So then we finally got it to where he would, even though he was gone, he would come back and produce some programs from time to time. So he agreed to do that. So we didn't completely lose him. But then the next thing I knew, he was going around giving, you know, talks about his trip to Hanoi. And in the course of those talks, apparently, was indicating that he had been censored and that he had to leave WBAI because he was censored, you know. And it just was not true. So I didn't understand quite what his agenda was, but then I found out that he was trying to get a job with Time magazine, and he was trying to use all this to get himself to the next plateau, which I thought was not very nice. But in the meantime, we start getting cancellations, subscription cancellations. People are outraged, you know, this and that. And then there, Susan Brownmiller wrote an article in the Village Voice, and she said she talked to Fat Cat Schweitzer, and Lou Schweitzer is the man who owned the station and gave it to Pacifica. And so he was the fat cat now. He did pay our rent, you know, which I thought was very nice of him. But he was a nice man. But she talked to me. She said, Albertson. And Albertson said, no. Schweitzer said, the fat cat Schweitzer said, I didn't like the program. But that was typical of Lou. He would say if he liked something or didn't like it, you know. But he would never interfere or say, you know, don't broadcast it. That was none of his business, and he knew it. And then in the same paragraph, she said, and Albertson said, we decided to make some changes. Because I had told her what happened with Chris we decided to make some changes. That's not the way it was. That gave the wrong impression. And so the way she had it, we did not include Chris Koch. So it was the fat cat who said he didn't like it. And then that would indicate that it was the fat cat and I decided to make some changes. It was totally twisted, you know. And so I wrote a letter to the Village Voice, you know, I said, what is going on here? And then Nat Hentoff wrote an article. And Nat and I were friends. Nat got me my first job. He got me my job at Riverside when I came from Philadelphia. And I didn't even know him then. And had always been very, very helpful and told me anytime I needed a letter of recommendation or anything, just contact him. And all of a sudden, here he's writing. He said, well, Chris Albertson knows a lot about jazz, but he's apolitical. Well, where did he get that from? I mean... I was anything. I was trying to appear, kind of balanced, you know, but apolitical. No, never. And so this whole thing sort of snowballed, and it got so bad that there was a, you know, how WBAI listeners are, sorry listeners, but probably still that way. But people get riled up over something, you know, and so. There was a woman named Claire Silber, and I think she had started something called the Friends of WBAI. And that somehow, and she hated me. We had a big fundraiser at the Village Gate, and we had Monk and Coltrane, we had everybody down there. It was incredible. And when I arrived there, Claire Silber was on the sidewalk with a chalk writing, Albertson must go. And she had already worked on the building because it had it all over the building, you know. And I said to her, Claire, you know, you're really wasting your time. anyway, where was I? I'm losing my train of thought.
Well, it's an interesting train. I mean, just let me say that there's something that is so vehement about these battles at this place.
Yes.
That is, I mean, it's not like disagreement about, you know, mode or strategy or something like that. This is a life or death struggle. I once heard someone say that Paris was a city where lovers would stop speaking to each other over an opera.
Yes,
and this is the kind of passion that people who who advocate the free speech through WBAI.
So what happened then was I went to work for the BBC, which is why I left at the time when I did. And I was flying back and forth, spending every other month in London, every other month here. And on one of my early trips back to New York, I found three letters in my mailbox from WBAI producers. There was Tana DeGames and Bob Bison and Barbara Dane, the folk singer. And they all complained individually to me that they had been censored. And the board refused to talk to them. And because they knew that I knew the board and the board knew me, they wanted me to arrange something. Barbara Dane had been in Cuba, and she had taped an interview with the head of the Vietnam delegation, who spoke English, so it was an interview in English. And she had brought it to Dale Minor, and Dale Minor said he lost it. So she had another tape, and she brought it to him, and he lost the second one. And then he finally just said, look, and he was, you know, he had a drinking problem. And he said, well, we don't need that propaganda here, which was so alien to what WBAI was supposed to be about. And Tana DeGames was edited also, and she was told that she couldn't do her program because she had the Spanish accent and people didn't understand her. And that was, you know, that was something we never considered. You know, you could have Bulgarian accents or Icelandic accents, any kind of accent, you know. It didn't matter. You didn't have to sound like you came from NBC. And Bob Bison was edited. He had covered the protests up at Columbia University. That got quite, you know, they got quite.
This is already 68.
Yes. And so that was a lot of that stuff was edited out. So I contacted Harold Taylor, and I said, we have these.
What was his position then?
He was the head of the New York board. And I said, we have these three.
How did he become the head of the New York board?
I don't know. That was before I came along. He had been for a long time. You know, these board members, they would just stay there because they never did anything.
Were they?
They were self-perpetuating.
Were they people who Schweitzer had selected, or
no.
Pacifica had selected?
Pacifica. And he was a former president
Chris,
of Sarah Lawrence.
I must welcome WJFF in Jeffersonville, Liberty, and Grahamsville, New York, and thank Miss Liberty for relinquishing her time so that we could have this discussion. WJFF is a radio station that is run by a water-powered generator.
I heard about that.
Yes.
On your show, yes.
Yes, and it's a great station. We're also heard on KWMD in Casilla, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and we are streaming on the World Wide Web.
Of course.
So, I wonder if we ought to open the telephones and ask people to call if they feel like talking to you about some of those days. I'm aware of the fact that most of the people listening weren't even born when these things were happening.
That's right.
So it may be of interest only to fogies like us.
Well, that guy who chants.
So there was this moment where you and Chris were pointed at each other.
Yes, because what happened with this then all blew up, and the Friends of WBAI became the committee to win back WBAI, which was a little stronger, you know. And it had on it, you know, a lot of important subscribers joined that. And so when Harold said the board couldn't see them, and they could see me, but not the three producers who had complaints. We did something kind of tricky because they had to tell me where the meeting was being held, and it was on one of the board members' apartments on Central Park West, and we had it all planned out that they would then show up, but in case they changed the location at the last minute, which turned out they did, we had an elaborate sort of communication system set up. So they changed in the last minute to they suspected something, you know. And so it was held in this apartment. And shortly after the meeting started, the doorbell rang. And there were the three producers with complaints, other very concerned members of the committee to win back WBAI, the steering committee of SDS, and this gentleman who was, why can't I remember his name now? Sounds like Mullins or something.
Ed McMullen?
No, this was an elderly gentleman whose father was a corrupt New York City politician around the turn of the century and had stolen a lot of money and died very rich and left the money to this guy, Alex Munsell. And to Alex, this was tainted money. So he gave it all away. And then he invented a process by which color can be printed very easily and became a millionaire on his own. And he loved WBAI. And he and his wife owned this little brownstone. They rented it out, but they had the basement themselves, had tape recorders down there, and taped everything that WBAI did, and regularly sent in money. And they were also co-editors of a communist magazine that they had rescued from oblivion. They were just wonderful people. But anyway, Alex Munsell was out there, and it was sort of a major contributor at the time. And so when Harold saw these people, his face just dropped. I mean, I've never seen anybody's face drop like that, but it really dropped. And he says, this is out of order. This is totally out of order. And Chris Koch wasn't there, but Frank Milspaugh was there. And Frank Milspaugh hadn't said a word all night. And he said, this is red baiting in reverse. I always remember that's the only thing he said. So anyway, we left. And I left with him. And then they decided to have a meeting at the Diplomat Hotel. Remember the Diplomat Hotel? Which was owned by fairly radical brothers, I think. And so we had this meeting there, an open meeting. We invited Chris Koch and all the WBAI people to come, not only come, but get up on stage and speak. And Flo Kennedy was one of the speakers. I was another one. I forget who else was. Just before we began, there was this guy sitting in the front row, and he was like heckling. And it turned out to be Leonard Lopate. And he didn't let us know that he was actually working for the station. He was planted there to disrupt things. And he had a secret tape recorder or something. We got that away from him because we had Black Panthers as our security, and they were mean looking guys, and Leonard wasn't going to fool around with them. And I had brought my tape recorder, and that was on stage, and I still have the tape, the whole thing on tape. Mm. And at one point, and Chris Koch was in California at that time, but he flew in just for this. And the sort of it reminded me of what's going on now with the GOP and all and the politicians on the Hill. All this spin, there was a spin going on. And after we'd had just enough of this spin, and it was just not true, one woman who was a subscriber got up, and she was really irate. She said, this is all on tape, I have been a subscriber to WBA for so many years, and what you're saying is nothing but lies. This is not true. This is not true. And then she started turning. And it so disrupted the meeting that Chris and the rest of the people from WBAI left. They never came up and talked, though they were invited. They walked out. And there was a woman, and I forget her name. She was kind of a silly woman. She would fit into WBAI today. But back then she was not. She was a misfit. She was a PR woman. And she was, you know, she really was a PR woman. She created all kinds of stories, and she didn't have much of a brain. She said something, I forget, very silly, and everybody laughed, and that's when they all got up and walked away. But Milsbaugh, the way he was hired, was very mysterious, because I called Halleck Hoffman, who was the president of the Pacifica Foundation then. And I told him that I was going to resign, but I wanted to, because I was going to go over to the BBC, but I had been hired so haphazardly myself that I was willing to stay long enough for them to find somebody, you know, within reason. And he said, I appreciate that. And he said, why don't you mention on your listeners' report that we are looking for a manager and give the qualifications and so forth. And then... he said, then you can interview people and select a few and let me know. And after the preliminary interviews, now come in and do the and continue it. So I found three people who I thought were eminently qualified. And one of them had been an assistant to Norman Cousins for a long time, and these were three very interesting people. So I called Halleck, and Halleck said, oh, that's great, and I'm coming in on such and such a day. And he said, set up the interviews. So I set up the interviews with Halleck. Halleck came in that morning and said, cancel all the interviews. Send them letters, tell them we found somebody. And I thought that was very strange, because he hadn't even talk to these people, and he was just dismissing them arbitrarily. And he said, I'm having lunch with this guy, and I want you to come along, because I think he's our new manager. And it was Frank Milsbaugh. And what made it even more puzzling was that Frank Milsbaugh not only had no radio experience whatsoever, but he wasn't even a New Yorker. He had just come to New York, so he didn't have any contacts in New York. He didn't have any feel for the city or anything. And there he was, just suddenly he was it. And I never quite understood that. So when I mentioned that to the committee to save or bring back WBAI, one of them had a contact at the Village Voice, and they had managed to get a hold of the newspaper clippings, you know, these publications like The Voice, they keep clippings of everything, you know, not their own, but, you know, everybody else's. And so they started going through these clippings. And they, at one point, they came to my apartment, and they had it all spread out all over the floor, you know, looking for Milsbaugh. Well, they turned out that Frank Milsbaugh had been a member of the American delegation to a peace conference in Helsinki. Helsinki Youth Peace Conference or something, I forget the name of it. And that was not on his resume, no mention of that. It also then turned out that all the American delegates had been planted there by the CIA. So obviously he had been working for the CIA. So this didn't make any sense. But then I started thinking about how he was brought in there. And, you know, I had long suspected Halleck was being a little bit, you know, funny in that way. And so it began to make a little bit of sense, but I still haven't quite sorted it out. But then I started getting, because people came to me because I had been the manager and I knew everybody, and that there were drugs being used and sold at WBAI. mescaline and stuff, and that some top people were involved, including Millspaugh. And I went to see Goodman, whom I had never seen before. And Mr. Goodman was really very, very nice. He immediately agreed to see me. And he said, "This is very serious." He said, "But I can't, as a board member, or the head of the board, I think he was at that point, there's nothing I can do. But as a regular listener and subscriber, there certainly is. And I'm going to look into this." And the next thing I knew, he had died of a heart attack. So, but at that point, then Dale Minor threatened my life a couple of times, and I just thought, well, I love WBAI, but, you know, I can't just throw my whole life away because of this. And I was happy at the BBC. So I just gave up everything. But I kept all the correspondence and all the papers, the clippings, everything.
You're on the air. Hi.
Hi there. Yes, let me take my headphones off. Well, things have not changed much, and I'll just mention, Chris, you probably know this stuff, but maybe you could kind of talk about what's happening today versus kind of things you were going through back then. Let me see. I wrote some numbers down here. One guy on the board, we've had some funny guys on the board, on the Pacifica board. One guy on there commented, "Please, no police violence before breakfast." And I think that guy was a lawyer. He was black. You know, we all think black good, white bad. Anyway, he worked for a law firm that was anti-union. So that was a good guy for the board. And another person on the board, I think he was black, meaning very good. He was he had his job selling radio stations. Got that? And
when was this?
The late 90s.
Oh, this is the coup. Already. This is back in the Christmas coup thing. That was the current board at that time.
10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, his job was to sell radio stations, and on the board of, and they're talking about selling BAI and so on. And
that's an old idea, isn't it, Chris?
Yes, and when I was manager, they wanted to sell WBAI, and use the money to support KPFA and KPFK. And somebody had offered them $1 million just for the frequency, because it's a great frequency and it's a commercial frequency. And they thought that was a lot of money, and it was very tempting to them. But there was a man on the board named Rudy Hurwitz, and he was the one man I could always talk to when something happened like that. And I went out to California and talked to him and told him, you know, and he immediately understood that this was not something, this was not a wise move and had to be stopped. So he stopped it. So it didn't come to anything. But the thought was there, and this is back in, you know, mid-60s.
Do you know about the JUC and the fights, the physical fights that go on at LSB meetings and stuff? Did that kind of thing happen back when you were there?
No. I was shocked when I saw some stuff on YouTube, and I couldn't believe it. No, that didn't happen. We had one lady working here who threw an ashtray at Paul Schaefer, and he was very upset, and I think he threw a typewriter back, but that was about that was about it.
Wasn't a toy typewriter, huh?
we needed all our typewriters.
You have these committees to bring back BA. There's a committee now, because what they had was, we're not paying our rent. There's no money to pay the rent or the Empire State building rental for the transmitter and so on, and all that. And so they finally sent these two people from California into here and they fired a bunch of people. They fired Bernard and all this stuff. At any rate, and there's been some tremendously good changes in the schedule. I mean, there's got some very, they did a good job. They cut the morning program from 3 to 2 hours, and then put something else in there, and that's been very, very nice. But at any rate, there is now another committee to save VAI or something, and this thing never ends.
And I don't think it will ever end. I think that's the nature of the game.
Now, you mentioned the CIA and stuff. I mean, seems to me that if Bloomberg and the chief of police and the head of the CIA, if they didn't have about half the members of the LSB being agents, they'd fire those people, you know? They wouldn't run those places anymore. This place has to be full of them.
What is the LSD?
Oh, local station board.
Oh.
That's the board you were talking about.
Different acronym.
New York board.
Yes. Well, when I became manager, we had an advisory board as well as the regular Pacifica board. And the first time I went to meet with the advisory board, it was in a big conference room near the UN, very fancy, like something out of a James Bond movie. They had some prominent people on there, and I remember Paul Goodman, the writer. I said, what have you people done for WBAI? And Paul Goodman said, well, I think that WBAI should never play any music by dead people. That was his input. And then I guess, you know, equally inane suggestions from others, but none of them had done anything. And the head of this advisory committee paid for the rental of this conference room. So when I told Lou Schweitzer the following day, what he asked me how things had gone, I told him what had happened. He said, listen, kid, he always called me kid, he said, I'll pay for the rent. Now that puts you in charge. And that's what he did. So I was put in charge, and I fired them all. Abolished.
Talking about during that time of the coup, there were other things. There was one guy, and I forget the name of the L.A. station, KPFK, I guess. Or that's Houston. I forget. Anyway, the
KPFK
LA
is Hollywood.
They had this guy that they wanted to get. They got rid of this manager at that meeting we were at. At any rate, he had fired 80 people. Can you believe that? Mm. 80 people.
That's a lot. Yeah, well, I'm not surprised to see that, you know, that this is going. But now you have a whole different system now because you have these elections and things. We didn't have that back in those days. Things were
a bold experiment.
A bold experiment. Yeah, things were very simple in those days, you know.
Yeah, the election thing came from a woman named Carol Spooner, the lawyer out in California. At any rate, this was back at that same time of the coup and so forth, the Christmas coup. And it went to court. They had, you know, finally the court decided that the WBAI, the people who were against selling the station, et cetera, that they won. And so all of that stuff it got put in then by the judge.
Well, there are some programs on now that would never have been allowed back in those days. They would have been considered just too bland and too, you know, lacking in substance for WBAI. They would just never, ever have made the air. And that surprises me and worries me.
I don't like the sports. They have sports now.
Well, they have this one sports guy who sounds like he's always off mic, and he may be very good at what he does, but he sounds like he needs a little...
Well, his father was the famous... Samori Marksman.
Oh, really?
Not quite, no.
No, not his name is for the guy then, but he's named for the guy who was this famous Samori Marksman.
It was a namesake, yeah.
Yeah,
he changed things around, did wonderful things. At least that's the story that I've heard.
The sports thing doesn't bother me. It's all this, you know, faith healing and medicines. Artificial medicine and all that hocus pocus I hear.
Apparently, it brings in the money.
They were selling CDs, but that was during the marathon.
They used to have Gary Null on, and Bernard White fired him. But that guy brought in like half the money the whole year. He brought in about half or maybe a third of the money. It's unbelievable.
I hear people people speak very well of him. I never heard him, but...
Well, he's on... Let me tell you when he's on. He's on at 91.5 from noon to about 5 minutes to one. And he's very good. He varies. Sometimes he's talking about quantum mechanics, which he knows absolutely zero about, talking about medicines and with quantum mechanics and this kind of stuff. Then other times he has he'll read off a article by Chris Hedges or somebody, and those are fantastic. And he gets real angry, but at the right people, these Republicans, and of course at one particular Democrat and supposed Democrat. And he brings on these speakers, and they're the same people we used to have on Democracy. On Democracy Now! In the morning program. The morning program has changed totally. It has become basically no interviewees. They used to have all these Philip Deep, whatever. These wonderful people. They would, maybe they cost money. We can't afford it. I don't know. But wonderful people on who were in Iraq or someplace. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. You don't hear that anymore. And the morning, the rush hour, is now pretty much a black program, 100%. And that's, you know, that's okay if that's what the listenership is. But I thought that it was supposed to be more across the board.
Well, when I was manager, I remember a call I got one day from Channel 13. And the guy was kind of a little bit embarrassed. And he said, Mr. Albertson, we need to borrow one of your Negroes.
When was this?
This was in the middle 60s. They had made an agreement with H. Rap Brown to be interviewed, and he said, I'm not going to be interviewed by a white person.
Well, he had a program here eventually every other week.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they all had, they only had white people over there. So we had a guy named Charles Hobson who was doing a program of black quartets. And I called him and I said, would you like to do an interview with H. Rap Brown? And of course, he jumped at the chance, which turned out to be his entree to PBS. But he went over there, but they had written all the questions out for him. So the questions were very white. And H. Rap Brown immediately detected that and said, where are you coming from, man? What's wrong with you? But that's how it was in those days. When I came here, we had a guy named Mort Perry, but he wasn't on staff. He was just, what did Mort do here?
I'm gonna let other people call in. I'll get off the phone. But this has been really super wonderful. Just stay all night, please. Okay.
Bye-bye.
I had just one reflection. I don't know, maybe kick it around a little. The fraction nation that has been spoken about at WBAI since its inception, is that more of a general tendency for any groups on the left to be diversified, composed as compared to, let's say, the Tea Partiers or something to the right of center? Isn't that sort of endemic for some unknown dynamic that always has kept the left at loggerheads with each other very often?
You mean that people at BAI split into factions?
Or? Yeah, isn't that part of maybe a larger phenomenon which I can't quite articulate that sort of...
I don't remember us having much of that back in the old days.
There are different schools of anarchism also.
I mean, there were differences of opinion, but it didn't get as heated as I've seen here.
I remember a song on a program called Songs of Social Significance about someone who... goes to heaven, and he says to someone, "Well, you call yourself a commie, but you ain't no comrade of mine. You may be a comrade with Karl Marx, and you may be a comrade with Lenin, but you ain't no comrade of mine because he was more doctrinaire." Then
I remember that.
You remember that song?
Yes.
Great song.
Do you remember the little guy from HUAC who used to come around? Maybe you never saw him. He came during the day. You know, HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee. They had this little guy. When I say little guy, he was very, very little and very paranoid. And he all but looked under my desk to find communists. You know, he told me there were communists everywhere and that I should be aware of that. And then I used to just sort of play little games with him. But when Marcia recorded the Klan, there was came a time when HUAC was investigating the Klan, and they wanted those tapes. So that was a dilemma, you know. Do I cooperate with HUAC and let them have the tapes, or who do I think about? The Klan or
freedom of the press.
Yeah, you know, so I decided I have to give them the tape. I'd like to see the Klan get it. But we decided to make it a little difficult for them. So I told them, I said, we're a very poor station, and we don't have blank tape. So we are not able to do copies of the tape until you give us blank tapes. And, of course, we told them, you know, twice as many tapes as we needed. But they came up with it. That was how we got tapes at one point.
That was a brilliant plan.
So but he was just a regular coming around there. Because we were, I mean, like I said, this was the commie station in town. You could, in those days, you could hardly ever take a cab and find the cab driver listening to WBAI. That just
unless it was Lou Schweitzer.
Well, Lou,
you're on the air.
Well, I was driving a cab listening to WBAI.
Yes.
How hard would it be to bring Gary Noel back on the air to raise money? I mean, so it seems like a no-brainer to me. And you know, in my opinion, if Bob Fass is not getting paid a salary out of respect, then I don't see why anybody should get paid. Why don't people just contribute their time?
Well, no, why don't they pay Bob Fass?
Exactly.
That's a great idea.
Yes. Yeah, we bring Gary Noel back. I mean, come on. It's a no-brainer. How hard would that be? I'm sure he would come back if he was asked nicely.
Well,
and we would solve the money problem, like, real quick, wouldn't we? Like the guy was saying, I remember those days with him and Emmy Goodman. They were banging it out.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can't rub two nickels together. Well, come on. It doesn't take Lieutenant Columbo to figure this out. I mean, you know, what? I don't understand why somebody hasn't proposed that already.
A number of people have proposed it, and another... I would say equal number of people have questioned Gary Null's primacy in the old days. It was not a healthy condition.
Well, I mean, he had, like the guy was saying, Marjorie Moore was on with him, and it was a wonderful show that he did. But, you know, we miss these people, but the thing is, I don't see any problem bringing Gary Null back. I mean, now that the...
Would you be surprised to hear that some people do?
Why?
Well,
because we're divided.
We are divided. Before we go too much further, though, I want to interrupt you for just a moment to tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia.
Hey, Bob.
That's in Canada. And WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty. And we are streaming at this very moment on the World Wide Web at a number of places. So,
Hey, Bob.
Hey, yeah, what?
As long as this is Bob Fass, it's WBAI, all right? So people should get hip to that. And Bob Fass should be getting a salary. I mean, I don't even understand... like, what is going on with that? But, you know, who this is, right, Bob?
No, I don't. I don't. But
this is the guy who always calls and supports Bush.
Uh-huh.
But I'm being good tonight.
I see.
I thought the liberation of 50 million people and the building of two democracies was a good thing, but, you know, I see the glass half full. But I'm not going to go there tonight. I just want to say that you're the greatest voice on the radio, and I've enjoyed listening to you for so many years.
Listen, you speak a good game, but if you actually send money to me, you'll be doing a good thing. Now, that would be much better than getting on the air. I mean, you could ask some of your imperialist friends for contributions. Too.
You want to do a three-hour call with Dick Cheney right now? Hey, the Republicans, we know how to raise money. All right? You want to? I'll get. Let me yes, get Condoleezza on the phone.
Right. Get some S&M.
You want
some S&M dancers?
Sarah would be good in the leather, right? I hope she comes out in the first debate with the leather and the like, the Catwoman with the whip. And well, he says, you went to the Berlin Wall and you apologized in front of the Berlin Wall for the liberation of millions of people when we did the same thing for these morons who were, right, you for the ungrateful Germans. What's the matter with you? Wow. That's going to be some debate. He's going to be humming and hawing. He's not going to know, he's going to be every which way from Sunday. He's not going to know which way it's coming. But, you know, I just think.
Yeah, oh, well, I'm not so sure that you do, but.
Did you lose that call, Bob?
Yeah, I did. You're on the air.
Yeah, China can raise a lot more money than Gary Noll.
China?
Gary Noll this afternoon was saying how much he loved the Tea Party. Gary Noll this afternoon was saying how much he loved the fascist Tea Party. They just had an important earthquake in China. Yesterday was a national day of mourning for one-fifth of humanity. Not that one would have heard about it on WBAI today.
Well, here you are saying.
Yes, Gary Noll was praising.
are you trying to prevent me from speaking?
No, you're trying to prevent me from speaking.
No, I'm not.
It's obvious.
Gee.
And because.
Well, we're not.
Gary.
We're not communicating, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Cloudy.
Yes, Cloudy.
Those stories were very interesting. When was that coronation? What year was that?
Oh, the coronation. That was...
67?
That had to have been in the 64, 65, somewhere.
But if Tiny Tim was there, he wasn't known until afterwards.
We knew him before a lot of people knew him because people like Tiny Tim gravitated towards WBAI.
Herbert Buckingham Corey.
I recorded him at the Fat Black Pussycat, and I believe that was the first time he was on WBAI. Then soon afterwards, Pushpin Studios, remember them? They brought out a record of Tiny Tim.
Yeah, no, Tiny Tim, actually, his manager brought him to the station and said this was the next big star.
Was and that Steve Paul?
I forget. He was a very straight...
He ran the scene.
Right.
I don't know who he was. He recited poetry.
Yes, Steve Paul's fabulous scene with the incredible Tiny Tim.
Yeah. And he went into this poetry about a pear, and it was a... The whole thing was about a pair. That's the only thing I remember. And he just went on and on and on and on. And then Tiny Tim opened his shopping bag, and took out his ukulele. And I remember not thinking he was going to be the next big star, but there was something compelling about what he was doing. So that's how he came into the coronation.
Yeah, he even picked up on Lenny Bruce's radar, one of his bits, I remember.
You're on the air.
Yes, hello. You know, I want to say that Bob, this show is fascinating, but I would like for your guests to correct me if I'm wrong, but back at that period, there was a lot of dissension at the station simply because a lot of the fairer-skinned commentators wanted to speak for black people, so they purposely went out and chose people that would agitate and annoy the audience is of right and left. Am I right?
No.
Well, and one other thing also is that, if I remember, do you know who Roy Innes is?
Of course.
Roy Innes at one time was very, very nationalistic, chauvinistic, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the arguments he was presenting was that when people who play revolution involve themselves in the serious revolution at that time, of course, segregation, et cetera, they have a tendency to want to be the spokespeople for these things. If you look at the attitudes of the blacks of that day, they may not have been as formally educated as some of you, but they had something that you all aspired to, soul, a contribution to the American culture. In other words, most of you have glommed on to those very black people and you resented them. When they declared that they should have a say-so in their rights, all of a sudden, hell broke loose. Am I correct or wrong?
You're wrong.
No? Yes, you're wrong.
At least I said it.
Thanks for giving me the choice. You're on the radio.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, this is very interesting because it's filling in a lot of blanks for me. I mean, I was drafted in 64 and finally inducted in 66, so that should place me time-wise, you know. I get a picture that there's a structural situation that has never changed at WBAI. But at the same time, everybody there, at the station, beside except for Bob and all the folks who seem to be calling in, it seems like we're back in the, you know, in the 60s, in the clueless time, because I hear a lot of people talking about things that they should know something about, but they don't seem to be aware. I mean, like issues of the legality of the out-of-court agreements and the lawsuits between Gary Null and Bernard White and all the other mess that went on, you know, in terms of Gary Null being brought back to BAI. I mean, that's like climbing, you know, Mount Everest or something like that. I guess it's doable, but what would the value in it be?
He said that he doesn't want to come back.
I'm sure. He seems to be quite happy over at what used to be the station of New York City, but I'm not. Well, they have their own problems over there too, I guess. But it does definitely seem as though not very much has changed except the players. I mean, obviously, you guys that were there in the beginning was, you know, a white upper middle class, I would say, well educated, very accomplished people in many cases, and you know that's kind of shifted a little bit these days, as the gentleman said. You know, in his time, you weren't going to have a medallion. Well, they were all medallion cab drivers back then. They wouldn't listen to BAI, but the people who listen to BAI now are different people. Totally different people, different time, different place. And even though the population of BAI has changed, this war between those who would commercialize the station and or, you know, vampire it and sell it, and those people who think that there should be something with heart, with soul, as the other man just said, this war seems to be just never-ending. You know, this is almost like a Tolkien, epic here, you know?
You know, it's been going on since the days of the Paris Commune.
Well,
the same battle.
My question
between people who think the way to change society is with pamphlets, and people who think the way to change society is with plays.
Commercialization was always
and paintings
a bad word around here. That we were talking about the first marathon. One of the threats that we threatened the listeners with was that, you know, we'll play something very commercial if you don't cough up the money.
Well, that's pretty much what's happened, isn't it?
And that's what I was going to say. Some of the stuff that we threatened to do is being done now, and that's just not natural for the station. But it wasn't.
And at the same time, there's a stack of people on air at drive time who shouldn't be anywhere near a microphone in terms of not having any real training or any awareness of their presence, their proximity to the microphone, plosives, other issues. I mean, I can't see how they should even be, you know, allowed.
That doesn't bother me, though, because that they can be taught that.
You know, yeah, but they've been around for years, the same people, and they don't want to learn.
Yeah, that's another thing. What bothers me is that the lack of content.
Well,
that's what really bothers me.
This is Bloomberg's New York.
You know, if you have something to say and it's important, I don't care if you're slightly off mic.
Yeah, well, off mic is one thing, but the inability to operate a board, the inability to deal with a simple thing like the phone. Well, I guess it's not so simple. You have issues there with your phone service, I know. But I do believe that it almost seems as though there's always some behind-the-scenes powers that be that put exactly the wrong people in exactly the right time to cause some kind of a problem. Now, the gentleman who said something like that earlier, I don't think he was correct, but I do feel that there has always been some kind of a back room control that somehow is always able to put a conflict on the air to create a situation that is self-destructive, and it just seems to always, you know, go on and on.
Well, Huey Bono.
But anyway, listen.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I normally don't listen to this at all anymore. I don't listen to you, Bob. I don't listen to the station. I'll tell you why.
Are you suggesting there's a COINTELPRO when you say Huey Bono?
But, you know, I'm usually listening to one of the streams of the BBC or Deutsche Welle or Radio Netherlands or something else like that because I can do that. Unfortunately, it seems as though the majority of your listenership are people who don't have the situation, don't have the dollars to, you know, have an internet radio, to have, you know, broadband service. And as a result, they ain't got no money when it comes to pledge time either.
I think there's something about that. I think probably that the people who have the money and have the interest have been scared away.
What's
happening?
There's a lot of negativity, unnecessary bull, you know, personal problems aired on the air, total non-professionalism. When I say professionalism, I mean, hey, you know, you're on the air. It's you and the listener. This is a very personal thing. And, you know, when you bring your family issues and the arguments with your girlfriend, you know what I'm saying? This doesn't do anything for the experience, because this is a form of entertainment, isn't it? Aren't you a performer?
It's supposed to be, but I won't mention any names, but there's one person I've heard several times. He always his show always starts with him talking about he went to the doctor and the doctor said this, and then he's suffering from this, and then and then he coughs a lot. And
he was off the air for a long time, and then he got back on. Yeah.
Oh well, that's terrible because it's so uninteresting.
Yeah, well, there's a whole lot of that comes back all the time.
And then he complains about the light flashing in the studio. And
well, light is kind of annoying.
He hates the new light that flashes.
Well, again, you know, I suppose that, you know, the fist fights at the board meetings and other things like that would probably, if they were, you know, broadcast live or podcast or whatever, they would probably bring in income. They would probably raise the listenership.
Well, I mean, from one point of view, you could say that BAI was branded as the place where people fight for the air.
Yeah, well,
yes.
But is it about fighting on the air?
Well, I don't know.
At times it is.
I don't know, but...
I don't know. Some I remember
you know too much.
That may be so. I've been around almost as long as you, Bob.
Yeah.
Well, I think now that, you know, the more people you have making decisions and influence, the worse it's going to get, because of the more conflicting opinions you have and the more fights and arguments you have.
Well, there's also the issue that was brought up earlier, and a lot of, well, it was kind of like, you know, just alluded to, and that is the presence of the destabilizing members of a whole variety of agencies, mostly, you know, governmental, local, state, federal, whatever.
There's another problem, too, that I think is really central to it. There are too many birds and not enough bird seed.
Well,
yes.
You know? You know?
That's what I would say. Yeah, that's it.
So where's the money? Where's the beef?
But where's the management that listens to the programs and says this is not serving any purpose? And either goes in and says you got to straighten up and do something with this program, or you got to be replaced. But people go on, it seems, year after year after year, saying absolutely nothing of any interest to anybody but their mother.
Yeah. At the same time, I look at the station the same way, you know, here in Harlem, we have this issue with what happened at the Harlem School of the Arts.
Uh-huh.
Well, what happened was very simple. They took the money and ran. You know, there was that last article by the Times, you know, the tax records tell the story. And
there's some sort of a New York State theater authority where they did the same thing.
Well, but see, this is what I'm trying to get to. It seems as though whenever it's something which, you know, benefited some kids, some people who were looking for a different point of view, open-mindedness, whatever it may be, you know, if it has to do with creativity, real creativity in the arts, there's always vampires, bloodsuckers, and a variety of other types who somehow manage to turn it into their personal cash cow, and they not only sell the milk and drain the blood, but they destroy what's left of the carcass. And unfortunately, it looks like a whole stack of people like that. I personally, you know, Bernard White, you know, I mean, he drove the station into the ground. I'm not really clear why he did it, because I'm not clear on what kind of personal gain he got out of it. But
I feel uncomfortable talking about people who aren't here, you know?
I'm not. Well, but you can go on.
Well, that's because you're not here.
yeah, at the same time.
This is a virtual conversation.
Yeah, kind of, I guess.
What's your name?
My name is Tony.
Tony, you've called before.
Oh, yeah. I've been around.
Yeah.
We've met. Like I said, I think I first, 1968 probably, when I got back. That's probably when I started, you know, being involved at the station, one way or another. Anyway, it's a pleasure, and
same here.
I'm going to keep listening. Peace.
Thank you. You're on the air.
Yes, I have information about how people can contribute to the fund for the Chinese earthquake, and I would like to share that information with the public.
Go ahead.
Well, let me go into my notebooks here, and could you hold on a second while I do that?
A brief second.
You can't give China a moment. You can't give it a moment.
Well,
no, you can't do that. You can't give me a moment to get my papers lined up.
You're on the air.
Hi, it's me again. I found some lyrics for that thing. It's lyrics within a lyrics, like a subquote within a quote. Let me just read this thing straight through. It's only 20 lines long. An old record album, Ballads for Sectarians, by Billy Friedland and Joe Glazer, circa 51, has devoted a satiric ballad to Spiro, and that's the other Spiro, I guess, who they call Bill Bailey. Some of the lyrics, reproduced here with permission to Professor William H. Friedland, went as follows, : Bill Bailey belonged to every radical party that ever came to be, / till he finally decided to start his own party so he wouldn't disagree, / he got himself an office with a sign outside the door with, quote, Marxist League in letters red, / for 17 years, Bill Bailey kept his office with the sign outside the door, / but he never, ever got a new member. Everybody made him sore, /... And so on that day, Bill Bailey passed away, and his soul to Frederick Engels, I lost my line, but let me go down. He finally gets down here. As he slammed the door back in old Carl's face, these were the words he cried, quote, "Oh, you may be a friend of Carl Kautsky and a pal of Ferd LaSalle. You may get along with William Lieb Connect and the First International. Yes, you may have inspired every radical party from the Hudson to the Rhine. Oh, you may be a comrade of all these folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine." That's all I found.
That's great. Okay. That's great. Hey, you don't think you could send that to me, do you?
Well, yeah, you could find it, too. It's only two. Google found about two things, and then I had to say, click on the more of the same stuff. But, yes, I will send it to you. What is your... what's your email? Something at BAI?
CabalRadio@gmail.com.
CABAL?
CABALRADIO @gmail.com.
Okay. And
Thank you. Who is this?
No, it's David Combs.
David, thank you.
Okay, yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
We're about to lose all our voicemail, I understand, too. It's a whole other problem.
You're on the radio.
Yes, good morning. It's good to hear the music, and it's also noteworthy to say that fish oil comes from salmon and other...
Snake oil. You're on the radio.
It's starting to sound like a Glenn Beck production with the anti-communism. I have information right in front of me now.
Anti-communism?
Of course. It's the anti-communist crap that just came over the air that you reported. This is straight out of the Glenn Beck playbook. Wow. Isn't that interesting? Isn't it interesting that this afternoon Gary Knoll praised the Tea Party? Isn't that interesting? That all these people are praising Gary Knoll today.
Oops. You're on the air. I always have this image of someone holding onto the cord of the radio and slowly lowering the radio down.
Now, here's what I want to know. A year ago, they had this report to the listener, which, you know, they had that a few days ago. But a year ago, they had it, and I was on the air, and I said, why don't you guys take a clue from WFUV, which is the... radio station of Fordham University. This is a station that anytime you go to a pop concert in New York, they have a table, they're giving away things. Well, anyway, a couple days ago I went to a concert. I went to see the ska band, The Specials. And there they had their table. They gave me a button, they gave me a bumper sticker, and they gave me a window decal. On the back of the bumper sticker was a pre-printed form saying, why don't you listen to WFUV? It had their what they have on their HD streams. Why become a member? Also, they even had benefits of membership, meaning they had things like a museum
discount.
It's a great
station. They have some very
They have their act
good,
together.
They have their act together.
They have
You're
their
right.
act together. Why doesn't BAI just look at it and then say, you know, why isn't, with all the music that BAI plays, why don't we have this at a concert? FUV had one of their radio people came out and introduced the band, you know, and said, you know, support the station and all of this. I bet a lot of people who were there for that show, for The Specials, never heard of FUV. And, you know, the same thing, just the awareness could happen to BAI, and it could bring in much-needed revenue. And you know what's really frustrating is I really think that, and I'm not trying to be egotistical here, I think that this is a very simple thing and that this could very simply be accomplished. And then I go to a concert and I see it and I say, well, why isn't BAI doing this? It's so simple.
FUE also has a much more interesting website.
I haven't even been to their website, quite frankly. Yeah. Anyway... It's just, you know, I think that BAI is always holding on by a hair. I just have to say, last marathon, I gave $25 to BAI. I can't be giving BAI another $25 this marathon. I just don't have that kind of money. You know, we need more listeners.
Well, we need more listeners with some money. What are you doing listening? Stop listening.
Stop listening, and that'll increase the pool. Huh?
What will you do if WBAI disappears? To say I need the radio station, but
we are the last frontier, my friends.
Isn't there something you can sell?
would you like me to sell my old vinyl collection to raise money for BAI? Is that what you're implying?
That sounds good.
That sounds good. Well, I don't know how much will old Pat Benatar records get these days.
Oh, it depends upon who.
It depends on who's buying them. You know, with eBay, You know what we should do? Here's an idea. How about we'll auction off dinner with a BAI radio personality, you know, on eBay. Now, that would bring in some. That should bring in, I don't know what kind of, maybe McDonald's budget, but anyway, just kidding. Anyway, thank you for letting me vent my spleen.
Oh, well, how is your spleen now?
It's well ventilated, thank you very much. It's doing quite well. Well, have a good night.
Good night.
Bye.
All the dirt and beneath all the sweat, who look to the future and knew what it meant. Were the hearts and the minds, the souls and the dreams and the eyes of the immigrants. Their breath in the morning light as New York Harbor sailed into sight. They stood on the ladders and the decks just to see the shadow of a lady known as Liberty. Hands gripped the rails, hungry eyes peered out. Some were crying from their eyes, some were crying from their hearts. Looking to the future and dreaming what it meant. Maybe a kid off a ship could maybe be the president. Out of Ellis Island they poured like sheep under the land and into the streets. With the hands of the children and the coats on the backs, they brought nothing more than they could fit in a sack. Be carpenters, steel workers, firemen and cops, pedal rags, sew shoes and own neighborhood shops. To work with the hands and work with the backs, bringing coal from the ground and putting smoke up the stacks. Eyes of the healthy and eyes of the lame, eyes of the free and the eyes of the chained, eyes of the wealthy and eyes of the poor. Eyes of an Indian who rides nevermore. Always remember and never forget. Beneath all the dirt and beneath all the sweat, who looked to the future and knew what it meant. Were the hearts and the minds, the souls and the dreams and the eyes of the immigrants. To settle, some couldn't out of fear. Some kept dreaming of a new frontier. Everybody was convinced they had a place in the sun. It wasn't what you were so much as what you could become. But everybody's future wasn't everybody's dream. The land could be barren and the streets could be mean. It's a fact in the ghetto and the farms and the shacks. If you only move ahead, there ain't no room to fall back. This is the home for the brave and the free. That's what we want the whole world to believe. Not everybody made it to the top of the heap. Some were dragged in chains from far across the sea. Some lost their way and some lost track. Some realize that you can't look back. Sometimes you hear it, but you don't know where. The sound of the waves still crashing in your ears. Eyes of the healthy and eyes of the lame. Eyes of the free and the eyes of the chained. Eyes of the wealthy and eyes of the poor. Eyes of the remember and never forget. Beneath all the dirt and beneath all the sweat, who looked to the future and knew what it meant. Were the hearts and the minds, the souls and the dreams and the eyes of the immigrants. Grand.
skies at sunrise, every sunset too. Forget those happiest years that has left a rosary of tears, my darling. Your fair face beams each night in my dream, in spite of all I do, everything seemed to bring memories
change my mind. If I could do it over again, if I'd known then what I know now, and I could rewrite history, I had the chance. Just one last dance to see if we could work it out. Well, I could almost see how my life would be. And I know without a doubt
said. What's done is done. You can't relive the past. The water's blown and so's the bridge. You can't relive the past. Memory runs right by your eyes, so real and so fast. The dam is burst, the acid spilt. You can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past. You can't relive the past.
The dam is burst, the acid spilt. You can't relive the past. I sat beauty on my knees, you can't relive the past. I ran my guns for Robert E. Lee, you can't relive the past. One lesson learned from poetry, you can't hide behind a mask. No mask could hide your liberty, you can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past, you can't relive the past.
No mask could hide your liberty, you can't relive the past. Your life turns gray, the kids leave school. It's so subtle, it's so cruel. Your knee has gotten rusty, the Wild West got taped fast. You sit with your remote control, you can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past. Sit with your remote control, you can't relive the past. Amuse yourself with anything, you can't relive the past. Mistakes are what they'll always be, you can't relive the past. The many things you thought you'd save were like stocks in a crash. Your future's now just getting up, you can't relive the past. No,
you can't relive the past. You can't relive the past.
Your future's now just getting up, you can't relive the past. Did you really think this world would change? You can't relive the past. Reality's not what headlines say. You can't relive the past. And suddenly it's all over. Before the sail reached the topmost mast, you're drifting like a wooden doll. You can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past. You can't relive the past.
No, you're drifting like a wooden doll. You can't relive the past. I walked out to Dexter Street at the crossroads. I heard a saxophone. So many loves are dead and gone. So many lives have crashed. I'll never know what to make of it. But you can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past. You can't relive the past.
I'll never know what to make of it. But you can't relive the past. Wake up now, that's all I know. You can't relive the past. The future's constant tyranny. You can't relive the past. Tomorrow I might draw a map, but most plans never last. Still it's fun, though you know you can't relive the past. No,
you can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past. Still it's fun, though you know you can't relive the past.
You can't relive the past. You can't relive the past.
Still it's fun, though you know you can't relive the past.
So what happens now is I find that people ask me repeatedly, you think about death now? You think when you get to this age, you know, you're a year closer to death. Do you think about death a lot? And I can sum it up in three words, every fucking day. It starts in the morning, early in the morning. You know, when you really want to sleep some more, even if the cat is meowing, even if the shower is leaking, even if they're having a construction thing across the street, you just want to get just 10 more minutes. And now I don't. I got up at 5:30 this morning because I know I'll have plenty of time to sleep when I'm dead, and it gets me right up. I realized, okay, I'm ready for this day. But I remember that was formed in my mind when I was a kid. And before television, my best friend was a radio. And Lionel Barrymore, who was the brother of an acting family of John Barrymore and Ethel Barrymore, and I guess was the grandfather or maybe the great-grandfather of Drew Barrymore. And he was in a wheelchair. He played Dr. Gillespie in the original Dr. Kildare series. So he did this radio program where he would spout in a shaky voice. He would say things like, "Happiness is not a station you'll arrive at. It's the train you're traveling on." And that was my entire philosophy from that. I didn't have to read Being in Nothingness or anything, you know. That summed it up for me. But I remember another time he said, "When you stop growing old, you're dead." And that one stuck with me, too. Again, it's literally true. But there was a magazine that ran an obituary of me. And it's very strange to see your own obituary. And I got a call from a fact checker for Associated Press at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, she wanted to make sure. And I said, "No, I said, it's not true. It's just a hoax in this magazine." And she said, "Are you sure?" I said, "I swear I would tell you if I wasn't alive." I know. And then on WBAI in New York, people started calling up Bob Fass and discussing it, you know, whether it was true or not. They had seen it and they felt it. And one woman called up and she said, "You know, I never even knew that he was alive till I heard that he was dead." And that's really good for restoring your false humility. But you do start thinking, you know, okay, well, what do I want my tombstone to say, but my urn, because I don't want to waste earth space. You know, I guess it would be something like, "Wait, I'm not finished," my epitaph. But then you start thinking, and you realize how from early childhood now, it's consistent with how you want your death to be. Because when I was a kid growing up, my mother would stand by the garbage pail with the plate, and she would just say, I'm going to throw it away. And I said, no, I'll eat it, because I couldn't stand food being wasted. We didn't want to waste anything in our house. We didn't want to waste electricity. We didn't want to waste water, and certainly not food. And so nothing would get thrown into the garbage. I would eat off everybody's plate until they were clean, and then lose weight from worrying about it. And so that stayed with me into adulthood. I would be at a friend's house and we're having dinner, and I would say, are you going to have that? You want to eat that? And then I started doing it in restaurants, you know, before the waiter said, are you finished? And somebody would say, yes. I say, wait, let me ask. Can I have that? And then I started doing other people's tables. You know, you could try it. You just walk by, and you see something. Wow, does that look delicious? Do you mind? And often they say, oh, here, try one. And so... So this feeling of not wanting to waste anything carries into my fantasy of what death will be like. What I want. I want all of my postage stamps to be used up. I want my bank account to be zero after all my debts are paid off and everybody is taken care of that needs to be. I want a little note to be on my collection of porn magazines saying this was all for research purposes. Which is true, it was in my case. And so I want it to be a fake death. I was just kidding, folks. And, you know, don't burn me into my... And don't cremate me yet. You know, so what are my plans now? What's going to happen? Because I'm not the only one that's getting older. A lot of my friends keep getting older. The musicians that we always listen to, they're getting older. I'm going to end up emceeing Geezer Stock. Okay. I'm glad you're all here. Enjoying the music? Are you having fun? I can't hear you. No, I mean I really can't hear you. Now, the porta potties lined up there. The ones that are marked blue are for those of you who have to pee every 2 hours. The red ones... For every 3 hours, there are less of them, and so on. I'm about to introduce the Rolling Stones. Here comes Mick Jagger with his walker. They're bringing Keith Richards on a gurney there. And, oh, I've just been handed an announcement. Do not eat the brown antacid. Anyway, it's been a pleasure being with you. It truly has. Thank you. Thank you. I just want to announce that next time I've been outsourced. And next time, my act will be done by a young man in Bombay. He's very good. He's rehearsing now. He's rehearsing.
Yes, midnight on the sea, band playing the Amagabadi. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Well, midnight on the sea, band playing the Amagabadi. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Yes, 1912. Jack Johnson whooped Jim Jefferson, wanted to ride over to England and fight some people. In the same year, they built up the Titanic for Mama Clayton Goodwood and said it wouldn't never go down. Jack Johnson said, that's a ship for me and wanted to get on board. He went down to Zephyrnado steamship line and got a ticket. He was punched out for the Titanic when he got up the curbside and wanted to get on board. The captain wouldn't let him walk the plank, see. You had to sit on the dock and watch it float away.
Jesse Johnson said, you go on ahead then, I'll wait for you to go on down. Jesse Johnson wanna get on board, but the captain said we don't haul no coal. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Jesse Johnson tried to get on board, the captain said we don't haul no coal. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Jack Johnson was left standing upside the pier when the Titanic floated past the Statue of Liberty and onto the North Sea. On that fateful day, around the corner into Nashville, straight on, straight on down. Titanic going around the curve, when they're running through the big iceberg. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Yeah, steaming all around the curve, running through the big iceberg. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. They set lifeboats all around, say the women and the children, let the men go down. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. They set lifeboats all around, say the women and the children, let the men go down. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Now Jack Johnson was back in New York City when they heard the news. He was so happy he wasn't on board, he started doing the Eagle Rock and all kinds of things to show how glad he was. Jack Johnson, when he heard the news, should have seen him just shaking his blues. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Jack Johnson, when he got the shock, might have seen him just doing the Eagle Rock. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Yes, midnight on the sea, band playing the Amagada Z. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well. Fare thee, Titanic, fare thee well.
It was in the month of April, 1912. Listen to the story that I'm going to tell. On one Sunday night, when that ship went out of sight, when they said, when the great ship went down. When they said, when the great ship went down. When they said, when the great ship went down. Husbands and the wives, children lost their lives. When they said, when the great ship went down. When that ship first left England, New York tried to come. Icebergs struck the vessels, could not make the run. Jake would ask and he went down. 1,600 of them was drowned. When they said, when the great ship
went down. Well, Chris, you think that the unsinkable WBAI is going to go down to the bottom of the sea?
I still hear enough really good things to keep it afloat, but I hope it doesn't continue going in the direction that it has been going.
Well,
I think some corrective measures are in order. That's just my opinion. I may be old-fashioned, but I like WBAI to make me think. And not think that I'm going to go somewhere else. So that's it. You know, I've said a lot on my blog about, you know, complaining about BAI, and I mean every word of it. But I say it because I love WBAI, and I was very alarmed to hear, you know, what was going on here. But it looks like it might be correcting itself or being corrected.
What is the address of your blog?
It's http://// stomp off with a hyphen, stomp-off .blogspot.com. That's it.
One more time.
HTTP, well, I don't have to do that. It's just, it's really stomp off, S-T-O-M-P, hyphen, I mean, S-T-O-M-P hyphen O-F-F, dot blogspot, B-L-O-G-S-P-O-T, dot com. But if you Google my name, it'll come up.
Chris?
If you Google your name, it'll come up.
Albertson. Well, alright.
Titanic pulled out from England, bound for New York shore. Titanic pulled out from England, bound for New York shore.
Yeah, sure.
But when she struck that iceberg, poor old she was sailing across the water.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple, one or two more things. There's a rumor going around about Gary Null that if he's going to come back, he wants a whole pile of money. That's one rumor. More maybe than a rumor, but that's what I've heard. His show is nowhere, nothing like the show that it was.
I'm going to go on to another call.
Oh, please do. Okay.
You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Oh, so, hello.
You want to help the station? WBAI still has the very same website that it's had for many years, except there's been a big improvement in it. And that improvement is that one can go to that website now 24/7 and donate money for the upkeep of the station. The website is still www.wbai.org. Very simple. You can do that at station break or any time you feel like it. Announce it. Urge people to go to it. And that would shorten the fund drive, too.
Good idea.
Okay?
Thank you.
Sure.
Let the women get off. Let the men go down.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I had heard a lot of lip service about bringing new blood into the station. Yet, in practice, there is one producer who has four programs and several other producers who have two or more programs. And that, to me, is a form of inbreeding, which I think brings about weakness.
Thank you.
All right.
You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bob. Have you ever thought of doing a podcast from your computer?
Not very seriously, no.
Because, I mean, just the music aspect of what you do, I mean, I think it would bring in a lot of young people who are interested in, certainly a lot of times not in the music that's being given to them, and it might and your podcast could be linked to the BAI website, and it's just another outlet if you did it like once a week, and you know there's internet radio. In other words, it would kind of set you up for the future, you know, like that song, "The Past Is Nice," but you know, and. I would suggest that maybe you look into it. I don't think it's a big deal to do it or to set it up once you get it going.
All right, thank you.
And it would be certainly appreciated by your many thousands of faithful listeners.
Thank you.
When that great ship went down.
Hi, you're on the air. Hello? All right.
Put it in pause.
Put your radio in pause.
Well, I watch on the internet. I don't have a radio.
I see.
I know. It doesn't sound good, but it's true.
Where are you calling from?
Well,
a lot of things I wanted to say. It's spring, and I seem to be doing a lot of things, much to my surprise. And that guy that just called back, and he was talking for quite a while before. You could see him. You could see him on the internet, on these videos that are on YouTube. There are the first 10 minutes of every meeting. So that's a new thing that I'm doing. And this would be, if you just search for the words, first 10 minutes, WBAI.
Thank you.
This would be the only thing you could see. And you could see him, and also, I found a new setting on my camera called, I forget what it's called, something like low light. Anyway, it looks, the conference room there is really a terrible place to take video, and it's an improvement, so it looks kind of nice in the conference room. Yeah, this is not a LSB meeting. This was a meeting of the Finance Committee. And I think this guy was at that meeting. He talked a lot. He's very intelligent.
A pale moon rose in its glory. She's drifting from golden west. She's told a sad, sad story.
You're on the air.
Hey, Bobby.
Hello.
How you doing, man? I'm doing good, man. This is a beautiful world we have here, and thank God for BAI. And, you know, I wish everybody would just, like, stop washing their laundry. Just start talking to the people and stop wasting people's airtime on personal business.
Well, do you wash your laundry in Lake Michigan?
Yeah, all the time. In Chicago, too. Man, Bobby, you guys are, is fracking still going on, man? I mean, like, there's so many things to talk about, and people are talking about people's underwear. World needs us. Everybody needs to save this place. They're fracking the water. The aquifers are drying out in the Midwest, near Dakota. I mean, the water is going away. It's tripping. It's gone. It's going. And then they want to frack it away. They want to just boil it to nothing and turn it into chemicals. And, you know, I don't mean to be an alarmist, but this is an attack on humanity. And the oil companies who own these companies are
Well, certainly is an attack on the aquifer that feeds New York City. If they do the fractioning of the fracturing of the Marcellus Shale to release the gas, the natural gas that they claim to be so hungry for, the water, after it's been used to pulverize the shale, goes back into the aquifer, and it's full of
400 chemicals.
Right, toxic, many of them.
It's just sad that it's allowed to go on, because they make a couple of billion up front, and it costs 30, 40 billion to clean it up. And cleaning up is impossible, because people die, the water goes on fire. Because people have no idea of the sadness that is caused by rampant greed for profit, because you can make some money digging some wells and destroying everything, and it's like you're a termite. It's like you're desertification of the world. These people are nuts. You can't buy water. Go buy water. You can't buy it. Go jump in a lake. You can't buy a lake.
Hey, listen to this.
Sorry.
Listen to this. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, Ben.
Hello?
Hi, Fred.
I was advised by my personal manager to announce that this is not Jack Hardy.
Uh-huh.
How are you guys? Are you still in the studio, Chris?
Yes.
Hi, how are you, man?
Fine, thanks.
We just stopped carrying your signal, so I'd like to ask you, if you're not busy, how would you like to apply for a manager job of a hydropowered radio station?
You're talking to me?
Yes, I am. I'm talking to nearly anyone who's qualified.
I think my radio days are over.
Oh, that's too bad. That's too bad.
Well, thank you.
Well, I couldn't be more in agreement about the Titanic listing. At least it hasn't gone down. BAI hasn't gone down yet. There are still some really bright spots.
It's not going down. Those people are just plants and just like Aljon provocateurs. They're just schmucks. I can't stand them crying. And
Michigan, the voice of sanity. Thanks. It seems like you may be the only one of the few people that are awake down there. You're not down there. You're over there. There was a just so you know, you should stay tuned in the future. Bob may air some of the recording from the symposium that was took place at the Cooper Union Great Hall last week.
Oh, about the fracking? About
yeah,
the
some great folks came in. Dr. Theo Colburn came in from Colorado. Chris Calvin Tillman came up from Texas.
Thank God.
Albert Appleton was there. Fellow Michelle, I forget his last name, from Temple University. It was really wonderful. And it was good to see a good turnout. I think I mentioned that last week. But the sound is notoriously bad at the Great Hall, but I spoke to the sound person, and there should be a recording off the board in the mail. And as soon as I edit it down, because it's about four hours.
That would be very vital to play, Fred.
It would be very vital to play, and I have to say, I'm not going to point any fingers. I mean, I know where they should be pointed, but I provided material for premiums for the last fund drive. And I don't know how it happened, but it was given to a program who knew nothing about it, and it just wasn't set up properly.
Those things happen. It'll just happen again. The better on the next marathon, it'll just get better. I mean,
I hope so.
People don't have experience. They don't have experience, and you know. But you know, the world needs all the help it can get. So next marathon or whatever the thing is, look, fracking, spread the word. Fracking is a crazy method to get natural gas out of ancient rocks, and it destroys everything in its path, and it creates a desert, and it makes holes. I mean, if you look at the landscape of a well hole area, it's larger than football fields, like, In a row.
It's nationwide at this point. I mean, it's not only the New York watershed. This has been running the country.
30 states are in trouble. We're getting killed.
And by the way, Dr. Colburn said it's 649 chemicals now that have been identified.
649
that are both injected and returned from minerals and poisons that have been locked up for 400 million years that are never meant to be on the surface. But anyway, I mean, it's too much detail to go into right now. Bob set it up really well. And again, anyone who hasn't been listening, we've been on this for 2 years, over 2 years, and I don't know why the learning curve is so slow on this. Other parts of the world, including Bolivia, Ireland, are way, way ahead of us. And I don't know why people are sleeping on this here. I mean, even the people where it's happening in their backyard just seem, I don't know. You know, there must be something in the water already.
I was wondering, was this addressed at the Earth Summit recently? You mentioned Bolivia. And
yes. Oh, that's the main topic at the Earth Summit in Bolivia is the water. Absolutely.
But fracking in particular.
And that's something, you know, you were saying, I don't know, trivia being discussed on the air ad nauseum, you know, like an earache or a whatever it may be, or some of the medical shows that are really have no, I don't know, they're just absolutely stupid. I mean, rub the snake oil on your head and it gets rid of AIDS and cancer and everything else, and you're supposed to believe this, and yet it's popular. So I don't know what that says about the audience. You know, I hate to say that. I really think that if this topic were presented properly, that people would really go for it, and it would be to BAI's benefit. You know, one of the last things that was a real bright spot was when Michael Warren, the attorney, and his wife Evelyn were in Brooklyn, and they tried to stop a violent arrest of a kid and the beating of a kid that was handcuffed behind his back. And someone called in live to a program. I just happened to turn the station on in the car, turn BAI on in the car, and heard it live. And, you know, it was like the old days. There were several calls, updates on what was happening, and it was like it was live, like a live remote. And that doesn't happen enough anymore. I know what the caller meant about the morning news.
Are you saying we should have people being
really
beaten
contentless?
Up?
But the bright spots, you know, enough criticism. Some of the bright spots are several new programs. It's great to have Robert Knight back, and also the producer from Law and Disorder. I think he's done three programs now. And I think the name of the program is
Michael Smith.
The Other News, or something like that. Oh. In Other News. And then he does some cutting-edge reporting, and it's really great. It's a really great addition to your grid. So I don't know. There's hope, but I think BAI is on the way back. But I hope it's not too slow of a climb.
Well, thank you, Fred. Thank you.
Hello.
What's the weather like there?
I'm sorry, I missed that, Bob.
I say, what is the weather like?
Oh, the weather, it's very cool tonight.
Huh?
It's high 30s, low 40s, and tomorrow's going to be nice. Today was nice, tomorrow's nice. Should take a ride to the country.
Sounds like a good idea. Sounds like a plan, man.
What? While it's still nice and clean. I guess that's all I have. I hate to go on a rant about people not wising up on this topic. It's sometimes it's a little disappointing, but I think Michigan has the right attitude. People will wake up, and this fund drive may be better. And there are several people other than myself that are willing to speak about the premium before they play it, and if they decide to use it. And hopefully the news will get out there. The one bright spot is in the Daily News, there was a quote by Andrew Cuomo that he wouldn't okay drilling if he were governor, which he probably will be, in areas that drain into the watershed. So that's a step.
That's about everywhere, isn't it?
That would be a good first step, but it shouldn't be done anywhere. It should be stopped anywhere in the country. It's really not necessary. It was never unnecessary to go more than a foot into the earth to sustain ourselves just fine, you know, 150 years ago. So why wouldn't it work now? And that's it. Let me let you.
Okay, Fred. Thanks for the call.
Take another call if you like.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for your program. And great to hear you, Chris. It was a great surprise.
Thank you.
You're on the radio.
Yes. Hello. Is your guest still there, Bob?
Yes, he is. There he is.
I have a question for you. You know, at one time there was a thriving black radio format on WLIB, and all of a sudden it disappeared. So a lot of the blacks were forced to seek refuge in WBAI. My question to you, sir, isn't it unusual to have a black president, a black governor, a black attorney general, and there's no station where black people can praise or condemn him? Do you know why?
I don't know why.
There's no black talk format. And may I say something? This is not my opinion, but unfortunately I'm sort of parasitic, and I've sort of grabbed a hold of this one. They said that the left was not comfortable with blacks speaking as seriously and as effectively as they were on their own format, so that BAI thought it was best to control them by incorporating them into their format so that eventually BAI can sell this to a commercial corporation and then blame it on the blacks, as they will do with Obama, as they did with Patterson. Comment? Hang up? Listen? Bye-bye.
You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Who's this?
This is Mike.
Mike?
Yeah, Mike Havener.
Right.
Mike Havener.
Right. Where are you?
Well, I've been listening to a great program, and a lot of things that I didn't know about. Chris was really before my time. But I finally heard something that I wanted to make a comment on, and that's about this fracking. I live down the road of this lonely road out in Colorado, and one of these oil companies had a lease on some property, and it had a well, and it was behind a big hurricane fence. And I started hearing this incredible noise. It was like jets flying over, and it was constant, and it just went on. And after about two or three days of it, I walked down the road to see what was happening. And there were about 20 huge trucks lined up with their engines running. And so I walked over to the gate, and a guy came out in a hard hat and said, "What do you want?" And I said, "What is this noise all about?" And he said, "We're fracking this well." And I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, we're pumping sand down in there." And it just was so loud that people who live in the area that haven't experienced it yet, I just want to warn you, it's like putting Kennedy Airport in your neighborhood for as long as it takes for them to finish that well. And great program. I really enjoyed this program. Thank you.
Thank you for that call, Mike.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
And you're on here.
Yeah, sir. This is Lieutenant Colombo calling, sir. I just wanted to know, is this where I can order the WBAI Gone Wild DVD premium?
Yes.
Is that right, sir?
Yes.
And one more question, sir. One more question about Lynn Samuel, sir. Does she like to ride the Hershey Highway? Because, you know, Mrs. Colombo, she doesn't like that kind of thing, you know. But my cousin Louie always said, you know, just don't have the avocado cake first, and you should be all right. What do you think, sir?
Coming back, I'm my phone on the way to Mexico and dance with happy naked girls. I'm gonna score some dope, forget the rent, overthrow the government. I'm swinging from the chandelier, I'm bulletproof. Without fear, things will be different when I have the world. Oh, yeah. Let's get drunk and break bottles in the alley. Let's get drunk and break bottles in the alley. Fire department cars on Main Street and throw up.
Chris Albertson, thanks very much. I hope maybe you'll come back again. A few things that are probably not as yet resolved.
There's always a great time.
There's always something to fight at about the fight about at WBAI. And now stay tuned for In the Moment with Ibrahim Gonzalez.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.